So Massachusetts is closed again, but not Boston Public Radio. So we'll start with Charlie Sennett and ask how the world champion Pats are seen in the rest of the world. Then we'll turn to things that really matter, like ISIS's latest atrocity. Then politics with former Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor Steve Kerrigan and Republican State Senator Bob Hedlund. We'll discuss other games, like at casinos or an Olympics. Then at noon, how can we resist? We'll discuss with you the game for the ages, Super Bowl 49.
Our TV guru Bob Thompson joins us to talk more about the Super Bowl, best and worst ads, Katy Perry's halftime show. Then we're going to ask you, after yesterday's TV-watching Super Bowl binge, will you be binge-watching Homeland or Game of Thrones tonight? And if so, are you perhaps a depressed and lonely binge-aholic? Then we'll talk snow, snow, snow. When did we turn into Alaska? And finally, Shira Springer from The Globe with the Super Bowl Sunday smorgasbord wrap-up.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, the day after the big win.
If you say one time during today's 3 hours, I am not a football expert, I am literally, we are all football experts.
Okay.
By the way, we're going to get to that in a couple of seconds, needless to say, but there's some serious business as well. ISIS, as you know, has executed another journalist, a confusing hostage negotiating triangle among Islamic extremists. Jordan and Japan were going nowhere. The result was the beheading of Kenji Goto. Meanwhile, the reverberations of a so-called successful hostage exchange are playing out. One of the five Guantanamo detainees who was released on behalf of Bo Bergdahl, I'm sure you remember that, is trying to get back in with the Taliban. Joining us to take on these and other international stories, like the Super Bowl, for real, is Charlie Sennett. He's a news analyst here at GBH. He also runs the Ground Truth Project, and as you know, he's the co-founder of Global Post. Hey there, Charlie.
Hey, how are you, Jim? Hi, Marjorie.
Hey, Charlie. So before we do get
a day for true New Englanders to make it in, right?
It is, absolutely. Absolutely. Before we get to some of the continued horrible stuff, I mean, you always talk, Charlie, about having a little lighter moment. So we're going to start with a little lighter moment, some good news here. I want to play some sound for you. Here is the owner of the New England Patriots, Bob Kraft. Mr. Kraft, to all of us, by the way, calling it a victory for the entire world.
I want to thank the great coaching staff, the players, because we are all Patriots. And tonight, once again, the Patriots are world champions.
Thank you, Mr. Kraft.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kraft. So obviously we're very excited here in Massachusetts. Not sure how excited the rest of the country is, but you know the world. I mean, does anybody care about this in Iraq or Iran or even Dublin or Paris?
Not that much, but increasingly so. And that's
really
what's kind of interesting. But I would say perspective first, Mr. Kraft, a little perspective. This is not a situation where the whole world are Patriots fans. And calling them world champions is true. And in my heart, it's absolutely true. And in the hearts of my sons and the joy on their faces last night, it's absolutely true. But you got to know that the world makes fun of us when we call ourselves world champions of things that only have an American league.
Does anybody play football in a serious way other than the United States?
Okay, I'm going to get to that. I just want to do one thing on perspective.
Sure.
And that is, look, 110 million people watch the Super Bowl. The World Cup has 200 times that viewership.
Yeah.
Now, that's 26 billion people. Now, how you say there's more people than there are on the earth?
Yeah, exactly.
So this is viewers. What that means is every member of the human species, on average, watches 3.5 or something like that games of the World Cup every 4 years. So There are sporting events like the World Cricket Championships that dwarf the Super Bowl, and we don't even think
about
them.
The World Cricket Championship?
Absolutely. You got all of India.
Of course.
And all of Pakistan.
Wow.
And all of many parts of Europe, particularly the UK, watching that thing riveted. And we don't even know what cricket is.
I don't know
right?
what cricket is. Is that where they get dressed up in the little tennis
Yeah, that
tennis
weird bowler suit? Thing.
Yeah, they have the little outfits.
Yeah. You know how I know cricket is Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx.
Bronx, sure.
Where you get Jamaican immigrants and West Indies who come, and it's a beautiful sport. I do not understand it. I lived in London for 5 years. I went and tried my best to get it. It's a nice day in the a long, beautiful afternoon in the greens watching this play out, but I can't say I understand.
Well, you're really a downer, Charlie Sennett. Okay.
No, wait.
Is there
How's that
news?
A downer? There's great news.
No, it's sporting
the
news.
UK,
it's wonderful.
The UK is going to try to create an independent team that would be a permanent team of the NFL in the UK. So the prospect of having God Save the Queen played just before the national anthem and the sound of the Patriots' muskets blaring would add a whole new meaning to Mr. Kraft's comment, we are all Patriots.
Well, by the way, they play a game a year in Wembley or somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm told, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I think they're sold out for the most part. Is everybody in the British tabloid press ridicules it, and then they sell out 80,000 seats or something like that.
Even 90,000. Yeah. So Wembley, where the soccer stadium, their equivalent to our cathedral Fenway, their cathedral to soccer is... or football, as they would call it, is Wembley, seats 90,000. They pack it every time they get a National Football League yeah. game played there. So the actual stands is amazing viewing going on in the UK. There's a real movement there. And this thing started in as early as 1984. And the way I know that is I was a kid in London trying to get a job, which I didn't get. And I happened to be on Fleet Street. And I saw all these guys in American football uniforms running down the street to raise awareness about what a great game it is. There's been decades of people who are great NFL fans in the UK working on this. That number's growing. We know that, like, all into the wee hours of the morning, their time, late night, our time, last night, thousands and thousands of viewers are watching this thing.
It was 4 a.m. when it ended in London time.
Exactly. Yeah. And what you have is football moving up in its ranking from 16th in terms of viewership in the UK to 6th within the last 5 years.
Wow.
So that's pretty exciting, and it's really starting to happen. So I think if you follow this, we'll see where it goes. But the idea is that they're going to try to put some form of a permanent team inside the UK. It's a ways off. But, you know, while those audience records rise, definitely the NFL is looking globally at the potential increase of an audience.
It's but, you know, you almost say, I mean, I think it's neat that they're doing that. But when you also pointed out when you started this, Charlie Sennett, that cricket and soccer are dwarfing the NFL, you almost think, well, okay, maybe more people want to see it in Great Britain. But people seem to be pretty happy with their own sports.
Yeah, I think they are. But I think the idea of the NFL is going to have to expand because, hey, there were all these jokes this year about how many people are sort of down on the NFL. And all you had to do was watch Michael Kirk's documentary, League of Denial,
yes.
and it changes the way you view the game.
Yeah.
Deflategate doesn't help. All these, the hype, the dollars, the everything is kind of ridiculous. But another place that's really intrigued by the NFL is Mexico. And I love this one. That was my favorite ad last night. Did you see it?
Which one was that?
So this was the ad that basically talked about first draft ever.
Didn't
no,
see
and they
didn't
had
see
this
it.
Godlike figure with a beard
oh,
come
I
out.
Oh, I did see it, actually.
And he
That's
says,
right. Yes,
he says they're handing out different things, and they say, in the first draft, biblically, ever, they say, Australia, you'll get kangaroos, and everybody
oh,
cheers.
Oh, Flutie and Jerry Rice,
yeah,
two of the actors
exactly.
in it. That's right.
But then they come to Mexico, and there's this polar bear with a sombrero on, looking hopeful, and they say, in Mexico, you'll get the avocado. And it's actually was an advertisement for the avocado and for Mexico. And believe me, Mexico gets it demographically that the NFL is hot and that, you know, this sort of seven-layer deep dish standard appetizer at every football party, the gold in it is guacamole. And that is a reality that they're capitalizing on inside the NFL ads. And I thought that was an interesting observation. The other big stadium for football, as they would call it, soccer, as we would call it, in Mexico is I believe it's called the Azteca Stadium.
Isn't it like 120,000 people?
110,000 seats.
Oh, my God.
They filled 103,000 in 2005 when the Cardinals played the 49ers there.
So you must have to have a telescope to watch the game.
Largest single audience ever for an NFL game was in Mexico. You know, the actual stadium audience, the in-person live audience. So I love this. I think this is really interesting, something to watch. It's got a long way to go. Don't want to hype it. But interesting traction and an interesting counterpoise to Mr. Kraft's assertion that the whole world
is mocking my obsession with this Mr. stuff, which we'll discuss with Shira Spring. You know, here's two things.
Maybe Charlie knows.
He doesn't. Nobody
why
knows.
Why we all have to call him Mr. Kraft?
I would not presume to know.
Okay, you would not presume to know.
Thing.
We'll By the try way, to find that out.
We're going to discuss that with Shira Spring later.
Yes, we are.
The reporters should be embarrassed.
It drives Jim insane.
You know, let me just say now
what I'm going to say. Every Monday morning.
I'm going to say right now.
Yep.
When reporters refer to the President of the United States, the first time they say Barack Obama or President Obama, what do they call him after that?
Obama,
just his last name. Mm-hmm. After the first,
not the New York Times, Mr. President.
Right. Well, of course, but yes. I mean, when they're talking about it, all these reporters refer to him,
Jim,
as Mr.
You know
Kraft.
What?
I mean, what is up
look,
with this?
It's almost easy to do that, to go there and to sort of look at the family there that owns this great team. But I think the whole of New England would say, put that aside.
Okay,
today's
fine.
Our day, man. Okay. Today's our day to love the Patriots.
Okay, on the upbeat.
Okay? That was
note.
The most amazing Super Bowl ever.
It was. I think you should find out. I think you should call
Mr.
Kraft's press person and say, Jim Brady wants to know.
Can I tell you one last thing about this? The way the NFL is going to – remember the commissioner, who's totally inept, makes $1 million a week practically. You know what they should do? They should just buy another country. And then they can introduce football there. In any case, let's go from wonderful and up, and it was one of the most
here
exciting
games.
Here we
go, down into the depths
down
again.
Into the depths.
But you know, there's a when all of us are watching the news over the weekend of this, it's ridiculous to even say horrific anymore. This repetitive beheading thing after this failed negotiation with Jordan. Jordan apparently, from what I understand, wanted to know that this pilot was actually alive. Confirmation, proof that he was alive.
The Jordanian pilot prior
to trading this Iraqi woman who was involved in some triple bombing in 2005. Obviously, didn't happen. Is there any reason to believe that this isn't just going to go on, and once a week, once every 2 weeks, it's a journalist, it's somebody else who suffers this just unthinkable kind of fate? Are we getting anywhere on this thing? Are we any closer to ending this?
The only place we're getting is realizing that ISIL, the Islamic State as it proclaims itself, is no one you can negotiate with. This is just depth of darkness, death cult.
You don't think Jordan would have cut the deal here?
I think Jordan would have cut the deal. I don't think ISIL's waiting around, or ISIS, or the Islamic State, or whatever we want to refer to this death cult as. We are dealing with something that goes beyond the organizational aspirations of a group like Al-Qaeda, as dastardly and evil as their intention was. This is different. This is like a metastasized cancer that is more aggressive than Al-Qaeda on many fronts. It's probably less pervasive than Al-Qaeda as an idea because it's just so dark. But it's like one of those really creepy unknown cancers that you hear about in some horrific case study that they just can't find an answer to. And I, that's how I think of it, as this real dark tumor on the world. And I think
we heard some good news the other day, assuming it's true. I can't remember the name of the city where apparently coalition forces, whatever that mean, retook what 90% of some
Kurdish forces seized the I'm forgetting the name too. I'll think of it in a second.
Okay.
But I mean, this was the big battle for that city up on the Syrian border. And the Kurdish forces celebrated a huge victory. There were literally hundreds of thousands of Kurds in the streets who were joyously celebrating this defeat against the Islamic State. But it's not a victory that I think we can yet rejoice at the defeat of the Islamic State. They're pretty entrenched. There's going to take quite a bit of focus in a long term to get to it. If I were going to say one thing about the Islamic State right now, to answer your question, Jim, about
Kobani.
What do we do? It's Kobani. Yeah. Thanks. And Kobani was the town that they had stunningly taken, right. And the Kurds were fighting for it back. The Kurds have finally gotten it back with the assistance of U.S. airstrikes.
Yeah, that's the other thing I was just going to interject quickly, is that I read where it took hundreds of airstrikes, and plus the troops on the ground. So it was not easy getting those guys.
No, and how many civilians were killed
exactly,
is going to be a big question.
Exactly, out of there. I mean, so it shows their tenacity.
You know, this Kurdish fighters, that's a quick programming note here. Remember when I went there and I spoke to you live from that area?
Yes,
I was with an amazing...
Hundreds of yards away from the actual fight.
Right, and I was there with this amazing Kurdish commander who I just got news of this morning that he was killed.
Oh.
And, you know, it's one of those things where you're like, here are these Kurds who are fighting so heroically alongside the U.S. and with the support of U.S. airstrikes, and we don't really hear about their losses. Like, if it was an American commander, we would have heard about this, but you don't there. And I just think this guy who made me, you know, he had a little Nespresso machine in his office, and he made us Nespresso, and he showed us, he goes, look, I know you're nervous, and I told him about how I had promised my wife and my kids I wasn't going to the front line. He showed me the armored vehicle we'd travel in. He said, look, we're going to go up. You'll be with me. I'll keep you safe. And this is how the Kurdish forces are, the Peshmerga, as they're known. Extraordinary people. Really, truly unbelievable people. So he was just someone I wrote about. His name is Colonel Mansour. If you go to the Ground Truth Project or to Global Post and you look at that coverage, you'd see a profile of him, a photograph of this heroic fighter who was part of taking that town back and is now, sadly, was killed.
How was
just
he killed?
Recently.
How was he killed?
You know, I'm waiting for details on it. I know it was in fighting, but I don't know exactly where. I think it was just happened. So
was this involved in Kobani's?
I don't think it was okay. Kobani. I believe it was on a push outside of Kobani, but I do know it just happened. So I don't have the details, but just to share that there are these faces to these human beings who are fighting on the other side. But the thing with the Islamic State is that these guys are doing a concerted attack on journalism, on freedom of expression. And you asked, is this just going to keep happening? And the sad answer to that is it's going to happen for as long as they have a number of hostages to kill. And the other sad truth of this is that the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, the aid workers, and the journalists who were going in there are not going anywhere near there because of this whole horrific landscape of orange jumpsuits and beheadings. And so what we have is a black hole where journalists can't do their jobs. And this is new. In the old days, I could cover insurgencies and I could even cross the lines. And I could go and I could interview Hamas or I could interview Hezbollah or I could interview some fighters. We even had interviews with the Taliban at many points. This is different. They are part of a new digital age form of terrorism and insurgency in which journalists can no longer cross the line to speak with them because we're no longer caught in crossfire. We're now in the crosshairs. That's a big difference.
Can I ask you just two last things about this? One, an annoyance that I have, and two, a question. Let's assume that this negotiations with the Islamic State and Jordan had ended up in the release of this Iraqi suicide bomber. How would that have changed the coalition's mission here? Would they have said, well, that was like Bergdahl, that's different. This is a
I think they would have said
fighter.
Exactly that.
So that's the Foley is one thing. The Foleys of the world. I don't just mean James Foley, your former colleague. But this is an actual fighter. That's a different deal.
I think that is how they would cast it, and that's how they would pitch it. I still think that we haven't heard from our own State Department about where they are on rethinking this policy. And we need to hear from them. You know, I shared with you that we went to the State Department.
Right.
We met with Secretary of State John Kerry. We talked about safety for journalists, particularly freelancers in the field. The State Department's been very good, I have to say. They've been very helpful in terms of recognizing what journalists are facing out there in the world. But we have to keep hammering them. They might want to be helping us. That's great news. But no excuse for us not to keep hammering them on some really big questions. One is impunity. 90% of the journalists who are killed in the world never have any form of conviction. No one's brought to justice. So the State Department should work on impunity. When they met with the Saudis, John Kerry, President Obama should have been very tough about their treatment of that blogger who they flogged, sentenced to flogging 1,000 times, 10 years in a prison because he dared to question the theocratic honor of the House of Saud.
Whose plight was not even raised by the president when he met with the new king of Saudi Arabia.
Exactly, Jim. So when the State Department says, we want to help you, I think we need to push back and say, then work on impunity. And also work on this issue of how are you going to rationalize the kidnap and ransom policy of the United States government? Because right now, the chaos and the down in the darkness dealing that we have on this doesn't work on any level.
You know, obviously, it's a terrible situation that journalists can't go into these areas because of ISIS, and aid workers are petrified of going there as well. But on the other hand, I was thinking that if they don't have people to capture and behead in some ways and make a spectacle out of, I mean, they can be beheading their own people, I suppose. But in terms of their impact in the world, that's going to take away a lot of their impact.
It's going to take away their impact. It's going to take away their revenue stream. Because remember, the European countries were paying for these
hostages.
So
there's an upside of this, I guess.
So they made tens of millions of dollars through these taking hostages, because European countries will pay for the hostages on average somewhere between $2.5 and $3.5 million. The United States, the UK hold firm on that they do not believe you should pay, for the obvious reason you create the perverse incentive for them to continue to kidnap people and hold them for ransom. So where this goes is a puzzle. I don't know exactly where it's going to go, but we have to remember that ISIS also has other revenue streams like oil.
Yeah.
So they're not out of business by any stretch of the imagination. They are a very determined enemy, and they're an enemy that is changing the game, particularly in relation to journalists and to an attack on freedom of the press and freedom of expression.
You know, one last thing on this whole ISIS thing, and this gets – I'm not going to mention the Mr. Kraft thing to you anymore because you've convinced me that I'm raining on the parade, so I won't. By the way, the parade is tomorrow. We'll tell you about it in a few minutes. The other thing that is putting me over the edge with journalists, mostly anchor people here, is referring to this executioner who we see in these videos, who appears to be the same guy, as Jihadi John, is almost like making him into a cartoon character. This is a vicious executioner,
and it just—it
literally every time I hear it, and it's being picked up more and more by the mainstream press. It is so disrespectful to the people whose lives were taken and their families. Jihadi, you know, it's one thing. Baghdad Bob, the PR guy, was sort of funny because he was a PR guy. This guy is a killer. What is with your colleagues who are doing this? I just don't get it.
They've done that kind of reporting or have colleagues who have suffered those kind of consequences for putting yourself on the front line, and it's an excellent point. I would just say, as a journalist, we should be asking the hard question, why don't you have that guy?
Why don't we have that guy?
I can't answer it. I know that it's a fair criticism to journalists to say, I don't hear you answering, you know, asking questions that hard about all the other people who are killed. Are journalists somehow a higher ranking of concern? And I don't ever want to create that impression. You know, civilians killed in war have no higher or lower status than journalists killed in war. War kills people. War is a terrible way to solve a problem. And if you've ever covered one, you know that it's just the worst, most boring, ridiculous event you could ever watch, filled with the greatest darkness you can see. So today, white snow, patriots celebrate. My duty, my patriotic duty, as Mr. Kraft would put it, is today to think not about ISIS, but to think about the patriots. Think about that unbelievable celebration last night. And I'll never forget the joy on my son's faces, all high-fiving each other, celebrating that incredible victory. And how about our town, man? I mean, I got four boys who I brought back from being born all over the world. And look at the titles they have seen. I kept saying this to them last night. You know, you got the Red Sox, the Bruins, the Celtics, the Patriots. We live in an amazing place here in Boston and New England. And today, we'll praise Mr. Kraft. And we won't think about ISIS.
Okay. Do you want to bring us back into the darkness?
Yeah, you're ruining this for me because we'll do this quickly. Then we'll have a couple of minutes.
All right.
This is a confluence of related stories. Cuba, now that it has a new relationship, and I may get this not exactly right, so that's why you're here, wants us to give back Guantanamo, which is on Cuban soil. Mm-hmm. Apparently, one of the reasons Chuck Hagel left as defense secretary was because he was not so crazy about the speedy shutdown of Guantanamo that the president wanted and promised.
He says that.
But it seems to me, as a I'll channel Marjorie again, as someone who's not an expert on international affairs, that the fact that one of the five people who was released
has gone back
to get us Bo Bergdahl back is allegedly on his way back into the Taliban. Is going to give huge ammunition, whether it should or not, to those who say Guantanamo should never be closed. We should never release any of these people except the ones that are, you know, on the tip of least harmful. That is what's going to happen, isn't it?
I think it is going to happen. And, you know, Hagel strikes me as one of these guys who, if you were the president of the United States, what a tough guy to manage.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's truthful, and I respect him for that. But he's all over the map. You know, he's critical of everything and yet supportive of nothing. And if he felt that way, then why didn't he push harder and succeed in getting it done? And
yeah, that's a great point.
I really have frustrations with this sort of internal, internecine tension that Hagel puts out there, because even he himself says the equation is worth it, Jim, to go to your point. He says that even though we know this guy is going back into the Taliban as a fighter, we think that exchange to save the life of one of our fighters, Bergdahl, was worth it. And, you know, I think in the end of the day, I would agree with that. I would agree that we're in a war. Prisoner exchanges happen in war, and they happened in World War II, and they happened in the Civil War, and they happened in wars of ancient times. So, you know, this is not unheard of. The Israelis do it all the time. I shouldn't say all the time, but the Israelis have done it in some very, very dramatic circumstances.
Well, especially in disproportionate numbers.
Giving 1,000 or 2,000 in exchange for one of their own.
Yeah.
So I think these are the compromises that an open, free society like ours has to make when you're dealing with non-state actors and you're dealing with people who are down in that depth of darkness. But, Jim, couldn't we have gone out today just on the Patriots and, like, the whole celebration?
Okay, let's do that. Say it again. Your kids are 12 to 17.
They're so excited, high-fiving.
I mean, it was a
wonderful day.
You know something? We really do seriously live in a dark time,
mm-hmm.
okay? And we've talked about this almost every time I've come on. We've been in a news cycle that is relentlessly dark. But you know something? One of the ways to fight against that is indeed to celebrate our own ideas and to celebrate what we have in this country and the amazing freedoms we have, but also the amazing joy those of us who live in New England have with this claim to title town.
You know
so
we call you in the newsroom?
That's how I want to go.
Charlie, you know we call you in the newsroom?
Well, don't say that on air. You can't say that word.
The Prince of Darkness is what we call him. That's not true.
Charlie said it today. It's the light overcoming the darkness.
Right.
That's
just trying to pull me down there, Jim.
He is trying to pull him down. Poor
Charlie.
He's down there all the time in the darkness.
Thank you.
He wants a little light. I don't blame you.
Thanks.
Charlie Sennett is the light overcomes darkness news analyst here at WGBH, where he also runs the Ground Truth Project. And he is the co-founder of Global Post. It does all this extraordinary reporting, Ground Truth and Global Post all around the world. He joins us every Monday. Whoops. Charlie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks, Marjorie.
It is our political roundup with State Senator Bob Hemland and Steve Carrigan. Stay tuned for that in 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. So on a day like this, it's pretty obvious if you've been listening, we want to talk about last night's game, this morning's storm, both of which we will do a lot of in the last 2 hours of the show. But there's got to be to work that into our Monday political roundup. And we will, here with us in Studio 3, to figure out how is Steve Carrigan. He's a Democrat. He most recently ran for lieutenant governor with Martha Coakley. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. Good morning.
And minutes away is, he just called us, is Bob Hemland, state senator. He's a Republican representing Plymouth and Norfolk counties, and he's apparently just minutes away.
And that's what
it's tough out there. Yeah.
It is tough out there.
It's interesting the Democrat can make it through the blizzard and the Republican can
from Lancaster, Mass, by the way.
Is that true?
45 miles away.
Wow.
Very impressive.
How long did it take you to get from here?
I left 2 hours and 10 minutes.
It took you 2 hours and 10 minutes to get here from
Lancaster? When you're from Central Mass, you're used to giving yourself plenty of time.
Oh, my God. That's terrible. Yeah. Did you come on the Mass Pike?
I took 495 on the Pike.
Because there was a jackknife truck on the Mass Pike.
Yeah, it was after.
Further up. That's good.
Hey, Steve, can we start? Since you are the Democrat here and Hemland, the Republican, just seconds away, let's focus on things till he gets here that are appropriate for a Democrat. You and Martha Coakley were convinced, obviously, and a lot of people were, short by 40,000, that you should be the governor and lieutenant governor of Massachusetts. But as hard as this may be to acknowledge, Baker's off to a pretty impressive bipartisan start, isn't he?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, I thought everybody in the state did a good job with the storm last week. I would like to see more plows out there today. Believe me, I've covered a lot of these states' roads today. But, you know, look, I'd like to see how week three goes in a four-year governorship before I give him an A. But he's done a good job. You know, he's hired a lot of good Democrats.
But isn't that really the issue? The face of this administration so far are some pretty strong Democrats, the Jay Ashes, the as head of economic affairs, sure. Stephanie Pollack, mm-hmm. one of the leading environmental people, as head of whatever she's head
or
of transportation.
Is that, yeah. Because there are so few Republicans.
Thank you, Marjorie, for
yes,
making my point.
Really, I mean,
it's not a deep talent pool,
and a
lot of them are in the private sector, and they may not be wooed back over to the public sector to take a probably lower paying job in an administration. You know, what I'm proud of in my party is that we have folks who are willing to work in a bipartisan fashion with the new governor. Look, I said the day after the election that I wish him well. He's my governor. I want to make sure that we have a great Commonwealth for the next 4 years. But we're going to, you know, continue to hold him accountable. But we should at least give him his first 3 or 4 weeks before we grade him.
Now, I want to ask you something about, I mean, parking today particularly is everybody's mind. It's going to be the whole scenario again with the shoveling out of the spaces and the saving the spaces and stuff like that. If people don't know, we had two very bad situations in the MBTA last week. On Thursday, there was this horrible deal on the Red Line where there was smoke in the car, mm-hmm. and people panicked. They had to, you know, shove their feet out the windows to escape because the doors wouldn't open. Then on Friday, there was another less serious but still scary mishap with the Orange Line. Everybody knows these trains are like 50 years old and they're in terrible shape.
Yeah.
So here we have that situation with public transportation being pretty terrible. We don't even have a T that goes down to the Innovation District. You have to take the bus. Now we have Marty Walsh talking about this pilot program taking away 200 parking spaces in Boston for like zip cars and the like.
Right.
I don't know how politically you do that when public transportation in Massachusetts is pretty damn bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a multifaceted problem that we've got. You know, the car sharing systems have worked really, really well. Zipcar's been a big success. It's the biggest named one out there. You know, I think the mayor's got to do what the mayor does every single day, which is balance some innovation and some interesting ideas that he has for how to increase access with the limitations of a city of Boston size, with the limited number of parking spaces that we already have.
But why – I guess that's the thing. Why would you take away these spaces? It just seems there's already more permits for cars to park in the street than there are spaces. Parking is a terrible problem. So Zipcar is terrific. We all understand it saves gas and it saves the idea of people having cars. But people still do have their cars. And when you can't get people around the city very well – this seems like a...
Well, it's another Zipcar and things like that are another way of encouraging people to maybe if they're making a decision about buying a car, can they use a Zipcar and use commuter rail? Some of these reforms and these ways of trying to change lifestyles and practices are really difficult to do because you have to do both at the same time. You know, when you want to reform DCF, you've got to make some colossal investments while still paying the freight of the normal system. Same thing with parking in Boston. If you want to encourage more people to take commuter rail and use shared cars, you've got to convince them with its practice. It's a very tough challenge. I'd like to see more parking garages in neighborhoods that the cities have so that people can get off the streets, particularly in days like today.
Yeah, but let me answer this too, is you probably don't remember because you and I have memories that usually last about 4 hours, Marjorie, both of us. When we did the debate here at GBH between John Connolly and Marty Walsh, one of the questions we asked him about was a development that had just been approved, I think, on the causeway. I'm not sure. Where this condo, set of condo units, new condos, had no parking. What Steve Kerrigan is saying, it's an attempt to encourage people not to just use their cars to get around Boston. So while drivers like you and me are not happy about it, the bottom line is it may be good for Boston and the whole deal that goes with it. No?
Yeah, well, this is another thing that, you know, you think when we're not going to talk about the Olympics quite yet. We will in a couple of minutes. But, you know, we talk about these transportation improvements. The one good thing from my perspective that could come out of these Olympics is that we do make these improvements. We don't get the Olympics, but that we make these improvements because now you have yet another crisis here with this very popular late night tea riding project that was started on a pilot basis, and everybody seems to love it. It's been very popular. It enables people, you know, the young college kids to go out drinking and not have the tea stop at 12:30, and people that work the late shift and so forth. But we seem not to be able to afford that either because we don't have enough money, and it could be the end of the late night service as well.
Yeah, I think that is a critical thing that we've got to look at issues like that. Our infrastructure across the base, we talked about this the entire campaign. That's why we wanted no on question one to make sure sure we could continue to invest in our infrastructure, things like roads and bridges, so we could take our resources and put them into commuter rails, into the T. I think that service is a great project. It hasn't gotten the private investment that I think it should. I mean, a lot of those folks, you talk about the college students who are on there, the colleges should be investing in it, but the businesses, where there are a lot of folks cleaning those office towers who leave those buildings late at night to try to get home to their families far outside the city because they can't afford to live in it, who deserve and need that in order to live in their life and make a living.
Now, Kate, joining us on the phone is obviously someone who's not nearly as tough as Steve Kerrigan. That would be Republican State Senator Bob Hedlund, who so far has been unable to get to the studio, unlike Steve Kerrigan, the former Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor.
Bob Hedlund, if you didn't know, 2 hours and 10 minutes it took Steve Kerrigan to get here. And you're,
do you have a good excuse, Bob Hedlund?
Well, he planned better than I did, I guess.
My assumption is the reason you were not here is because you were trying to figure out, like everybody in Massachusetts, is Tom Brady a Republican or a Democrat? Because he clearly is the future of. Do you have any idea, Bob Hedlund? You know a lot of people. Do you know?
I don't know. It might have been like the woman I met in South Beach one time, and I said to the bartender, "Is that a man or a woman?" And he said, "It's whatever you want it to be."
Oh, jeez. Sorry I asked the question.
Okay. I mean, I don't know what his politics is. Who cares what his politics is?
Yeah.
Good point. Fine point.
Where are you, by the way, Bob Hedlund?
You know, the snow doesn't bother me with my Nordic jeans and all of that, but the expressway was basically impassable. I'm down in Milton right now.
Oh, okay,
so let's address something.
He lied when he said he was 10 minutes away.
It's not so much a partisan kind of thing. Let's talk about the Olympics. There's an interesting poll that came out of Mass Inc. a couple of days ago, starting with you, Bob Hedlund. It says the people in Boston support an Olympics, just like the poll in the Globe said the people in Massachusetts as a whole support the Olympics. Two interesting things, though. By a 2-1 in the Globe poll, I think it was done by Sage Industries or something, people don't want taxpayer funds used. And interestingly, while Bostonians, by almost a 20-point margin, want the Olympics to come, by a huge margin, they want the people to decide. Where are you on this whole question that the public should decide, a la the Evan Falchuk potential ballot question, should decide about whether or not Olympics comes to Massachusetts, Bob Hedlund?
Well, I'm pretty close to Evan Falchuk. I looked at this issue and looked at what the results have been around the world in the past, especially in recent years, with cities that hosted the Olympics. I don't think it's a good deal. The potential, I guess, is there for some benefit, but it hasn't been the case. And, you know, I've heard a lot of promises from a lot of politicians in Massachusetts, Jim, like, you know, the Big Dig is on time, on budget, that kind of thing. But I do think that there are taxpayer dollars at risk, significantly at risk. And I do think the people should absolutely have a say in this, and I think the legislature should have some debate on this, which we really haven't had any. The only debate we've really had is when we set up a study, if you will, and I think I was the only person to get up and actually talk about it and try to engender some debate at that time, and I was the only no vote for the study in the entire legislature. So I've been a skeptic from day one, and as this process unfolds, I'm becoming more skeptical the more I look into the issue.
Steve Kerrigan, the thing I don't understand is if Evan Falchuk's ballot question is no taxpayer funds or some variation on that, and that's what he said to me right. And others, I guess, last week, and if everybody involved in this, from Democratic mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, on down or up, says no taxpayer funds, what's their excuse for not supporting the ballot question that would affirm exactly what they say they're promising the public? I don't get it.
Well, you should talk to them about what their
rationale is. We did. We asked Marty Walsh about this the other day, but what's your take on this?
Look, I think this is a great exercise. And Marjorie referenced it earlier about our planning process and what the city and the Commonwealth will go through to sort of determine our readiness to host. We're in this process. We're going to be in it until September of 2017 at the soonest. And then hopefully, I hope the IOC does choose Boston as a host city, because I think we can do a lot of great things. But it's what we use with this time. And the senator's right. We've got to put a lot of protections in place to protect the people of Massachusetts. We got to make sure that we're not leaving them with a bill when this thing is over.
What is the protection? We heard there's a $25 million insurance policy, which is like nickels and dimes.
It is nickels
and
dimes.
Unless there's a multi-billion dollar insurance policy, I think everybody agrees with you, there have to be protections. What are they?
Well, there's different ways. I mean, as the former CEO of the Democratic National Convention.
We should have mentioned that, of course.
Okay. And We had letters of credit that were required by the city to make sure that if we had fundraising deadlines that fell short, and we had marks all the way along. I think we should look at those types of issues with 2024 so that the public understands where we are throughout the process. The biggest thing when we hosted the convention here in 04, when I was chief of staff, hosted Charlotte, and then working on both the president's inaugurations, is getting the community to understand the process from day one. If you get them involved and engaged in it, they'll understand
should
the
big
benefit.
Should they vote? Should they have a right to vote?
I think if they get the signatures and they get it on the ballot, they should vote. I'm concerned about putting every big initiative like this on the ballot, but we have a process, and if it makes it through the process, then so be it.
We're talking with Steve Kerrigan. You just heard Steve Kerrigan right there. He just ran for lieutenant governor with Martha Coakley. He's a Democrat, of course, and our Republican is State Senator Bob Hedlund, who's in a snowdrift somewhere down in Milton, calling in. Now, Bob Hedlund, I want to ask you, because I tend to think you might be more likely to agree with me on this one. You know, one of the reasons I think a lot of people are very skeptical about the promises of the Olympics is because so many promises are made in Massachusetts and not kept. And I think a classic example of that just happened where House Speaker Bob DeLeo, and he's a great guy. We all like him very much. He's been on Jim's show a lot, and Jim likes him very much. But he himself, 4 years, or I guess 2009,
six years ago,
thank you, reinstated this term limit on House speakers, and he, of course, is now the House Speaker, and supposedly to restore trust after three speakers in a row were indicted for various crimes and misdemeanors.
Convicted. Felons.
You're correct. They were indicted, convicted, and they are felons. So now he does a turnaround in 2015 as his own term is coming to an end, says he doesn't want the term limits anymore. This, to me, is just the sort of thing that breeds cynicism in Massachusetts about the State House and about everything else. Where are you on DeLeo's turnaround?
It's huge. Breeds huge cynicism. I think this is very bad. It just adds to the terrible perception that people have of elected officials and politicians. It's just complete, I hate to say it, it's complete hypocrisy. And I got to be very diplomatic here because, you know, I want to get my legislation through the House. but the amount of power centralized in the hands of the Speaker and the Senate President, quite frankly, over the years has made most members, you know, cower. They're afraid to challenge. They're afraid to challenge the establishment within the institutions. And you know, this argument about, well, you know, it puts the House as an institution at disadvantage, and it makes the Speaker a lame duck. Well, with your term coming up and expiring, and if you're concerned about being a lame duck, give up the gavel, hand it off to someone else who's now going to have the 8-year run, if that's a concern. But the House itself, as an institution, has power. They're a co-equal branch of government, and it shouldn't really matter who the Speaker is in terms of this lame duck perception. They're going to have the bargaining power with 160 members behind them. So I don't buy that argument at all. This is just about holding on to power and nothing else.
How about it, Steve Kerrigan?
Well, look, I've throughout my whole campaign, we talked about restoring trust and getting people to believe in government again and getting people invested in government again. This is a big issue. I, for one, was opposed to it 6 years ago. I think the founders gave us the term limits and gave us all the vote. We get a chance to vote in Bob DeLeo as a representative, and then his caucus gets a chance and the House gets to vote him in as Speaker. I'm not necessarily certain I would have done it the way he did it. I don't think it's a smart move from a legislative leader perspective. There is a lot of power in those offices, as the senator said, but I think the way to deal with that is to, you know, really on the grassroots level, start electing reps and senators who will stand up to those things and continue to fight. The way to do it is not to hamstring any one person to a certain number of terms.
Okay. We've heard that. Get them out there to vote for many years, but
well, we're trying, Marjorie. Okay. You can't.
You know, we have to do
politics
someday. Do you know what just occurred to me?
What?
Off air, Steve Kerrigan, we have to bring up an issue with you. Marjorie was locked out of the 2004 Democratic convention, and she was stuck at the door with Alan Combs.
Oh my!
And Triumph the Comic Insult Dog. The three of them were outside.
Right.
We'll have that conversation some future month.
We are talking politics with State Senator Bob Hedlund and Steve Kerrigan. This is 89.7 WGBH. We're going to keep talking politics. A little bit about Mitt Romney, a little bit about Scott Brown, all that coming up. Stay with us till the top of the hour. Well, actually, stay with us till 2. But we're going to talk politics at the top of the hour.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're continuing to talk politics with Republican State Senator Bob Hedlund, apparently at some Tedeschi's, and Steve Kerrigan, Democrat, former candidate for lieutenant governor with Martha Coakley. Starting with you Bob Hedlund, on Friday we heard that the bids, or at least one bid, came in for the remaining casino license on the southeastern Massachusetts. There may be an extension for others, but what was most surprising to me is that who one of the bidders was not, which was the Native American group that wants a casino on the South Shore, which means potentially, since they are allowed by federal law to have the same level of gaming, as the supporters call it, otherwise known as gambling, as the state allows for commercial casinos, if the Gaming Commission awards a casino to a private entity in the South Shore, southeastern Mass, we could end up with three casinos, a slots parlor, and a Native American casino. How does that sit with you, Bob Hedlund?
Well, first of all, just for the record, I'm not at a Tedeschi's. I am actually at a state facility here, my own personal emergency command center, a park and ride in Milton.
Thank you. Okay. Sure, you voted against the funding for it, Senator Hedlund. Go ahead.
Oh, no. We love intermodal facilities and
okay,
park
sorry.
And ride
go ahead. So what do you think of that?
Well, I mean, we knew that going into this debate we had a few years back on gambling. I got caught into that trap and started calling it gaming also. But we knew that, you know, we knew going into this we could have that level of proliferation in this process. And, you know, there's a rate of diminishing returns, and we've heard all the arguments. It's obviously a battle that I've been on the losing side of now twice because I led opposition along with then-Democrat Senator Susan Tucker in the Senate. It was a bipartisan effort to defeat the bill in the Senate. But also, you know, I was in support of the ballot question to repeal. So I'm 0-2 on this one, Jim. We know the arguments, and the people have spoken, I guess, through their representatives once and in the ballot box the second time. And I guess this is what we want. But I don't think this level of proliferation is particularly good. The biggest, you know, there's a lot of arguments against the expansion of casinos, the introduction of casinos in Massachusetts. But when you consider what the impacts are going to be to society, the impacts are going to be to the lottery, and there will be impacts to the lottery. The difference with the lottery is, you know, we know that that's somewhat insidious. It's regressive. But at least the so-called profits, if you will, and that's what the state treasurer calls them, the earnings, stay in the state. Whereas, you know, a lot of the earnings with casinos, quite frankly, are shipped right out of state to these out-of-state casino operators.
You know,
so I think it's a downer for the state. I think we're going to look back at some point and say this really wasn't such a great social experiment.
You know, Steve Kerrigan, this the casinos were essentially a Democratic initiative. Deval Patrick embraced them, which surprised a lot of people, yeah, particularly liberals. Sal DeMasi totally opposed them. And then, of course, he left to go to prison. His replacement, Bob DeLeo, totally supported him. An amazing 65 reps had an epiphany overnight and changed their position. But Hedlund, I can't believe he didn't take credit for this. Hedlund was the first one to say, if we're going to do it, let's do one and see how it goes. Charlie Baker embraced that in his campaign 4 years ago. And actually this campaign, too. But now he says what's done is done or some such thing like that. Isn't this a concern to you and your fellow Democrats? They're closing them like crazy in Jersey. Revenues are down in parts of Connecticut. We have potentially 5 gambling palaces in a few years. Isn't that a concern to the Democrats who gave birth to this thing?
As not one of the Democrats who gave birth to it, it is a concern, but it's a concern that we make sure we stay focused now on implementing it. I was opposed to the ballot question repealing it because I didn't think it was the right message to send from a business development and investment perspective. And I said then, let's let the vote happen and then go to work implementing the will of the people. It has always been a concern about the tribal casino adding to the bottom line number. I would have probably said, and I said this long ago, wanted one casino in the original bill too, but the legislature in their infinite wisdom passed the way it is, and you know, if we had done that, we would have just had possibility of two with
Native
the tribal one.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Marjorie and I have often quoted the former governor and almost presidential candidate as having the best idea ever. Mitt Romney, when he was governor, said what should happen instead of doing casinos. There was no legislation then. We should go to Connecticut and say, you give us $250 million a year and we will not build a casino in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, Bob Hedlund, were you surprised the other day when Mitt Romney on that 11 o'clock conference call said, no mas, I'm not doing it a third time?
Can I just add one more thing on casinos before I answer that question, Jim?
Sure.
You know, the 65 reps that had the epiphany, some of them are the same 65 reps that had the epiphany on term limits for the speaker. And they'll probably have another epiphany later on taxpayer a bailout of the Olympics should we get them.
So, no kidding.
Marjorie's right.
I'm with you.
You had a lot of promises, you know, relief tax, property tax relief. We heard that promise, 1,000 new police on the streets. You hear a lot of promises coming out of Beacon Hill, and I don't put too much stock. And as someone pointed out, I think on your show, there's already taxpayer money being spent on the Olympics. It's already being done. You get some staff that are devoted to this that are on the state payroll. So it's already happening. As far as Mitt Romney, I wasn't surprised. I think you know, I don't know Mitt's mindset on this. And I have to say, it was a joy to work with him as governor. The guy did a lot for the state that he never got a lot of credit for, quite frankly, in the area of transportation reform. School building assistance was his baby. Democrats embraced it by kind of stealing it from him and then giving it to the state treasurer. But a lot of good he did. I loved him as a governor. I thought he would make a great president. Ran a whole campaign the second time around. I cringed at a lot that I saw. But I think he's got a lot of good people around him, including a couple of his sons who have some pretty good political acumen, and they probably sat him down and said, Dad, it ain't going to happen.
Hey,
I really think that's what happened.
Steve Kerrigan, we only have a minute left.
Sure.
Most people think that this clears the field. Not most. A lot of analysts think it clears the field for a pretty moderate candidate, particularly on some issues like immigration and those things. Jeb Bush, is he Hillary Clinton's, assuming she's the nominee, and I'm not convinced yet that she is.
Right.
Is that the Democrats' worst nightmare, Jeb Bush?
If he can actually get past the Republican primary, I mean
because he's too moderate.
He's too moderate. I mean, Ronald Reagan wouldn't be able to get through the Republican primary the way they have them now. The bottom line for Jeb Bush and for Hillary Clinton is they've got to give a rationale for their candidacy. I love Hillary. I supported her before I supported President Obama in the primary last time. But they've still got to give a rationale to the people. That's what it comes down to. When you're running for office, you've got to be able to convince people that you're the right person for the right time.
Now, Bob, you can't control yourself. You have 15 seconds. We're almost out of time.
No, I mean, Ted Kennedy's aide. By the way, I just saw some 20-year-old footage of me and Steve Kerrigan at the same rally in Columbian Square in South Weymouth recently, Steve.
I was wondering if you'd remember that.
Oh, boy, we had some fun that day.
Hey, Bob, you just used up your time. Senator Hedlund, you'll finish the sentence next time.
Good luck driving the rest of the way, wherever you're going, Bob Hedlund. Bob Hedlund is a Republican state senator representing Plymouth and Norfolk counties. Steve Kerrigan is a Democrat who most recently ran for lieutenant governor.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to have a Super Bowl conversation for you Monday afternoon. Are you surviving today's storm by basking in the post-game glow? We're also going to get a call from the governor. Governor Baker's going to call in. I assume he wants to talk a little bit about the road conditions out there and maybe a little shout-out to the Patriots as well. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio.
Kicking off the noon hour at Boston Public Radio, how can we resist? We'll discuss with you the game for the ages, Super Bowl 49.
Our TV guru, Bob Thompson, joins us to talk more Super Bowl, the best and worst ads, Katy Perry's halftime show. Then we're going to ask you, after yesterday's TV-watching Super Bowl binge, from the pregame to the game to the postgame celebration, will you be binge-watching Homeland or Game of Thrones tonight? And if so, are you perhaps a binge-aholic? Then we're going to talk snow, snow, snow. When did Boston turn into Alaska? And finally, Shira Springer from The Globe with a question on everybody's lips, or at least Jim Browdy's lips. Why do they always call him Mr. Kraft? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. So here are the headlines, Marjorie. She's smiling already. The Boston Globe returned to glory. The Herald, history. The New York Times, tale of comeback is Tom Brady's to tell. Obviously, those are just a handful of today's headlines on You Know What. We want to know, what's your Super Bowl headline? We rarely do moments like this, but this is a pretty huge day in Massachusetts. Did the Pats redeem themselves last night? Is it possible not to love Tom Brady? You see him in that white outfit this morning? Oh, my God. 877-301-8970. And as you just heard Jordan report, the mayor minutes ago announced, the mayor of Boston, that there will be a parade, but not a rally at City Hall at the end of the parade because the parade route will begin at 11 o'clock at the Prudential Tower. and end at City Hall. But again, there will be no rally because of the cold and snow and
Jim,
those sort of things.
You left out the best headline.
What is it?
From the New York Daily News.
What is it?
Balls of steel. New England Patriots snatch victory from Seattle Seahawks in wild last-minute goal line stand.
877-301-8970. By the way, the governor is going to join us for a few minutes. Primarily, we think about the weather situation, but we'll get his take on a pretty big day for Massachusetts and New England. 877-301-8970. It's really all things Patriots. Again, we rarely do something like this, but you rarely have a game that's as exciting. I don't care. If you're a non-fan, you had to have somebody who's a friend call and say, I know you're not watching, but I would suggest you turn on the television for the last couple of minutes of this.
Oh, gosh.
What
it
a
was
a, game.
It was a great game. And it was just so – I mean, obviously, after all the Deflategate talk, everybody was so excited to have, you know, the Patriots come back, we presume, with correctly inflated balls and do so well and have it be such a close game. And you also – because I think a lot of people are quite – wrapped up in Tom Brady and wrapped up in his being able to, you know, there was supposedly the curse of the Babino. You know what that was, of course.
Yes, we do, Margaret.
After Tom
curse.
Brady left Bridget Moynihan, he couldn't win
horrible.
Any Super Bowls when he was married to Gisele Bündchen. So the curse of the Babino is gone now because he is, of course, married to Gisele Bündchen. She didn't have to make any cracks after the game. Like, well, my husband can't catch the ball, can't throw the ball and catch it both. Remember that?
At when Wes Welker before? Didn't catch the ball,
yeah.
That would have beaten the Giants.
So everybody's really happy about that because he is 37 years old and he won his first Super Bowl when he was quite a young man. And now he's won another. He's still a young man, but in football ages, 37 is not that young of a man. You know what was interesting, too, is last night I was coming back through just driving around through the city and how the cops, and we should talk to Bill Evans about the next time he comes in, and there were state cops as well there. They had Kenmore Square pretty much blocked off. From
Not pretty much. They blocked it off. They closed it, I think, in the third quarter.
It was blocked if you were coming across Commonwealth Avenue. It was blocked if you were coming off Beacon Street. It was blocked at Park Drive, Huntington Avenue, all the way down. But there were a lot of good reports of people posing with the cops and taking their pictures and everyone smiling. So call in with your Super Bowl stories, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. How great was this win yesterday? It was pretty spectacular. You know, if you have any dogs.
Listen to her, by the way. Listen, I love this. I mean, this is not a huge football fan, and that's what makes it so good.
I'm a fair weather fan. I'm like the pink hat. You would call me if I went to Fenway Park. I don't watch football season long, but I used to watch football all the time because I didn't have any brothers, so I had to watch football with my father.
Your boyfriend
you
in high school was
a
captain.
I had a
football
boyfriend
team.
That played college sports and high school sports, so I had to watch all his games. He was very good. And anyway, so I was into football then. I'm not so much into it now, but yesterday was such a great game. 877-301-8970.
Patricia called a minute ago, and she had to go apparently because of the snow. And her line to the person who answered the call here at the Boston Public Radio was, "Who's deflated now?" That's a pretty good, good line.
One.
You know, what's great. Now you would assume because the unfair description of Cambridge, where I live, is we're too aloof to care about things like a Super Bowl. In fact, Cambridge is a pretty working-class town. It's got some elites, but it's pretty...
Some elites.
You know what was great? Everybody's windows are closed last night in Cambridge because it's really freezing kind of thing.
Yeah.
Every significant moment that happened, particularly, obviously, when that rookie, Butler, made the interception that clinched the victory, you could hear through the closed windows and the cold, the roaring on the streets of... It's one of those... like Charlie Sennett was trying to get us to fall. It was this unifying, wonderful, just for a moment maybe, incredibly happy kind of night. 877-301-8970.
Speaking of Butler, and he's the rookie that caught the interception.
Undrafted rookie.
I know.
Isn't that amazing? Alabama or something is the college he went to? It's amazing.
I've never heard of it. Anyway, Kristen said this is her brother's headline who's visiting from New Jersey, not Buckner. Butler.
That's
and of course,
pretty good.
That was a reference to the ball that went through the hands of what was Buckner's first name?
Bill.
Bill Buckner, who was the Red Sox player, and he didn't live it down for years because they lost the World Series. Everybody said because of Bill Buckner, that wasn't really fair. But this Butler guy, I mean, right before that, as everybody recalls, you know, I thought it was doom. I mean, they're
that
the Seahawks.
Bobbling catch.
They're first and goal. You think they're absolutely going to make it in there. Oh, the bobbling catch. That was the other thing. The guy.
Listen, I love this. You just keep going. This is great.
The wide receiver. Who's the wide receiver?
Curse.
Thank you very much. The ball goes up in the air. Yeah. He falls down. He's on his back.
It hits his legs.
It's bobbling around over his hands, and he catches it.
You should be a play-by-play person.
Well, it was just unbelievable. And you
were it's particularly unbelievable because you're – oh, go ahead. You're about to say
Terry, the guy before. Was that
Tyringham.
His name? Whatever the guy was.
Tyree.
The guy caught the ball that bounced off
his
head.
Yes, helmet. His helmet.
And he caught it behind
Giants.
His helmet, which reminds you of what unbelievable athletes – these guys are. You know, and you wondered if the ball had been a little bit more deflated, if he could have caught it more easily when it was coming down the sidelines. Our number is 877-301-8970. So if you have dogs in your family, this is a really funny thing.
This is unbelievable. Because I've never heard you like this.
I was at a place with dogs, and you know, everybody's...
They were roaring through the game?
Well, because everybody's jumping around. The dogs are getting all excited. The dogs are barking to beat the band. They don't really know why they're barking. People are dancing with their dogs. Yesterday was a great day to have a Great Dane. You know why? Because you could dance with the Great Dane. When the final seconds were counting down.
You should know what people are – the reason she referenced that, because some people are going to say that is the most ridiculous reference ever heard.
No, they danced on Boston Common.
Right. There was a huge article in the Boston Herald where Margie used to work years ago with photographs of people dancing with
Great
Danes.
Great Danes, absolutely.
Nothing improper there.
But you can dance if you have a little dog as well. You just hold a little paws.
Let's take some calls. I hope that – is it Tileman? Is that how you pronounce your name from Rhode Island? Hello there.
Tileman, yes.
Tileman. Tileman, thank you. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Very good, thank you. Happy day to you.
You too.
my exciting thing about last night, I was here with my friend Jeff Leach and Bill Mittendorf, who was a former Secretary of the Navy, and we were jumping up and down, and Jeff Leach jumped so high that he ruptured his plantaris.
Oh, no!
Why are we laughing?
That's
the tennis puncture, okay?
That's a pretty good story. Tillamon, thank you much for the call. Let's go to Duxbury.
Well, did you see Brady jumping up and down?
I mean, that was
very exciting, too.
Ann in Duxbury, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about what everybody is talking about, the Super Bowl. Hi, Ann.
Hi, nice to talk to you guys.
You too.
Well, the thing is that I couldn't possibly miss Downton Abbey, as Marjorie can appreciate. So I was here by myself, and I'm switching back and forth between Downton Abbey and the game. I missed something about Mr. Bates, so I'm going to have to watch Tuesday night to find out what the heck happened with
him. Are you going to make our bosses happy in this building, Ann? Let me tell you.
But I did get the very end of the game, so I was very excited, at least. So I got both things that worked out really well, and I was so excited.
That's great, Ann. Thank
and
you.
And I'm not even a football fan. I'm a Red Sox fan.
Well, it's pretty – I mean, the Downton Abbey reference, too, is pretty obvious. Ann, thank you very much for the call. Before we get back to more calls on yesterday and the amazing victory last night about 10 o'clock at Super Bowl 49, here we believe primarily to talk about the blizzard, but my guess is he also wants to celebrate, is the relatively new governor of the Commonwealth. That would be Governor Charlie Baker. Governor, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, folks. How are you?
Great.
Now, I suspect you are not calling about the Patriots' spectacular victory, Governor Baker, but maybe about the weather conditions outside?
I was calling to talk about the weather conditions, but I, like everyone else in New England, and based on the early returns, pretty much everyone else in the free world, I did watch the game last night. Yep.
Yeah. Were you jumping up and down in the swamp, Scott?
We were jumping up and down in the swamp, Scott. Although I'll tell you something, the Butler interception at the end elicited more spontaneous, childish behavior than just about anything I've seen in a really long time.
But how can you not love it?
That was just me.
No, but the guy's undrafted from West Alabama, which most of us know didn't exist. And you know what was beautiful, Governor? I assume you watched a little bit of the post-game show. When he was interviewed repeatedly, this Butler guy, he couldn't talk. He was so moved. It was so beautiful. It was incredible.
Well, the other thing that's really interesting about that is he was the guy defending Curse on the play where Curse caught the ball with his feet. So there was a little bit of poetic justice and all that.
Yeah, there really was. What would you care to tell us what the childish behavior was that you indulged in after the interception?
Just lots of hugging and jumping up and down, and you know, I looked a lot like. Well, I didn't look a lot. I engaged in the same activity with friends that Tom Brady was engaging in at the same time.
Okay.
He was doing lots of jumping up and down, too.
That's beautiful. Now, Governor, obviously you have another issue to deal with. You dealt with a pretty serious blizzard last week, and you've got one of lesser, I guess, intensity, but not insignificant. What's the deal, Governor Baker?
Well, we started talking about this with DOT and public safety and DCR, and which is sort of the key agencies that deal with this stuff, on Saturday. And they all basically, you know, and the Weather Service, okay? And all the way through, people basically said, look, this is a typical New England storm, but it's not, you know, the storm of the century. It's not going to be like the storm we had 2 weeks ago. And yet the storm we had 2 weeks or a week ago creates all kinds of issues for us. But there was nobody who was saying, you know, travel ban, state of emergency, everybody should stay home. And we did our last call at 4:30 this morning on this stuff. And that's pretty much been, you know, go slow, be patient, use public transportation if you can, recognize that there are parking bans in many places, including Boston, and that those parking bans are going to affect your ability to get around by automobile if you haven't called ahead. But there was very little coming from anybody we were talking to who said, you know, we should treat this storm anything like the way we treated the last one. So we didn't.
Are you taking heat for this? I have to say, I haven't monitored this closely this morning. Are people being critical, saying you should have resorted to similar measures as you did last time? Is that where
I mean, not surprisingly, there's a fair amount of back and forth on it. You know, some people are saying, you know, it's a big storm. You should have told everybody to stay home. And other people are saying what you would expect them to say. This is Massachusetts. This is New England. This is where we live. This is what we do. I do think the, you know, for me, the most important thing about this was the people that I had watched work their way through and manage the storm last week, which I thought they did a very strong job on, you know, to a person, basically said, yep, this is a big storm. We should treat it with respect, but it's not the storm of last week. And we did have, remember, we had 3 or 4 days that we spent a lot of time with front end loaders and dump trucks and all the rest clearing out big snow piles and all the rest, and taking them in the snow fields and using snow melters to melt them. And is this problematic? Sure. I mean, I was driving around in this from about 5:45 this morning until almost 9 o'clock, just making my morning rounds from one place to another. And traffic was slow and traffic was tough, but that was exactly as it usually is when we have one of these. My major message to your listening audience is, you know, south of the turnpike, this thing is probably going to turn to rain sometime this afternoon. It may have already started to turn in some of the areas down in the South Coast area, and that's going to get slippery and sloppy toward the end of the day, and people just need to be really careful if they're driving.
So there's no, Governor Baker, no early dismissals or no one's, 5 o'clock, the regular work day, people are going to work to and then go home.
Well, this is not an exact science, but on the call we had yesterday afternoon and the one we had this morning, the transportation people basically said the morning commute will be a little messy. We'll have all day while people are at work to clean up and clear out and plow and all the rest. And if people go home on a normal pattern, which is people start leaving at 3:30 or 4 and continue to leave until 6 or 7 or 8, so you have kind of that extended commute, we will be okay. I mean, we won't be perfect. It's going to be, you know, like I said, patience and being cautious and careful are going to be required. But people actually said that an early release would be a really bad idea, and that a late start would also not be a good idea, and that the best thing here would be to take advantage of the timing associated with the storm and people's traditional patterns with respect to work, and to factor that in and act accordingly.
Hey, Governor, last question for me. Is it safe to assume you watch this thing in Swampscott rather than in Arizona because of the storm?
You know, I made a decision a couple of weeks ago that I was going to watch it in Swampscott. I mean, okay. I've been watching football games with my neighbors forever, and it really wasn't that close a call. I mean, they won when they beat Indianapolis. You know, I toyed with the idea of maybe going out to Phoenix, but I didn't toy for very long with it.
What'd you win?
And in retrospect, I'm really glad that I didn't go.
Yeah, I think it was a wise move. Before you go, what'd you win from? I knew what you bet. What did the governor of Arizona have to ship you?
It's actually the governor of Washington, Jim.
Oops, sorry. Oh, I guess that's true.
Marjorie, I hope you get that one.
I love that.
And you use it against them.
I will. I use whatever I can.
Thank you, Governor. I appreciate that.
The clam chowder, believe it or not. We're going to get a ton of clam chowder from Washington State, and we'll distribute it here to a food pantry.
I don't think it can be even close.
By the way, those coffee cup cupcakes from Springfield, they're 3-0.
Governor Baker.
Thank you, Governor Baker.
Thanks for your time.
For calling in.
Okay.
Much appreciated.
Care,
have a good rest of the day. I want to mention that we're going to be talking more about the snow a little bit later in the show and my theory that we're turning into Alaska around here.
I think it's a good theory. And by the way, the governor will be with us for Ask the Governor on February 19th in studio at noon. 877-301-8970. Back to the Patriots. We're having a mini celebration here on Boston Public Radio. The march or parade or whatever you call it, tomorrow was just announced by the mayor. No rally because of the cold and snow. The parade tomorrow is at 11 o'clock. It starts at the Prue, ends at City Hall. Let me tell you, they're going to move really quickly in this weather. Let's go to San Diego. Apparently, Susan is calling from there. Hey, Susan.
Hey, hi.
Hi.
It's gorgeous here. It's 75 degrees and the sky is blue.
I bet it is. Thank you for
telling us
that, Susan. Go ahead.
On my street last night. Here in San Diego, there was such celebration going on from the Patriots.
Wait, they don't hate the Patriots in San Diego?
Yeah.
Wait, yeah or no?
Yes.
Yes, they do hate them, or no, they don't hate them?
Well, on my street, there were flags out for the Patriots, and there was screaming going on at the end of the game.
Susan, that is excellent news from the West Coast. Thanks for sharing it with us. Thank you, Susan, calling from San Diego. Good news from one street in California.
Well, I told you, my kid who lives in New York City couldn't find anybody that was a Patriots fan. Everybody hated them to watch the game, so we had to go to the Patriots party and then the Super Bowl party and then leave and go home for one other guy in this apartment to watch the game with.
Speaking of your son, didn't you go to one of the rallies at City Hall with him
when
it was the coldest day of the century?
I think it was the first one.
Was it?
It was the one where they were all – that was before they had the duck boat tours. And it was freezing, and Ty Law was dancing with Bob Kraft. Remember that one?
Oh, I do.
That was
great. In the fur coat. That was great.
I could be wrong, but I think it was the first one they won. And we were up in the high riser with the press people. And it was just – everyone was just frozen to death. You were huddled together for warmth and keeping yourself out of the wind.
You know, we've mentioned Mayor Walsh, and he did a press conference at 12 o'clock today to announce the parade. I want to play a little sound from the mayor. Mayor was here on Friday of last week. Marjorie, to the mayor, was fawning over the quarterback for the Patriots.
How can
you course,
not?
Would be Tom Brady. And we saw Mr. Brady this morning, Tom Brady, looking resplendent, if that's the proper terminology, in all white. He looked lovely. Here is the mayor talking about doing something nice for Marjorie vis-a-vis the greatest quarterback who I believe ever lived. Here it is. How much would it take for you to introduce Marjorie Egan to Tom Brady? That's all that really...
I couldn't
what
take
would
it.
She have to provide for you
it.
To get...
maybe, if we're all lucky, maybe next Tuesday I'll ask Marjorie to come to my office.
Oh, my God.
Mayor, that is one pledge that the people will require that you honor. We will be in touch
call
with the mayor's
in,
office.
But I don't know if it's going to work.
Marjorie, you can take the day off.
If it's not going to be a
meet
rally.
Meet him at the Prue.
Meet him at the Prue.
Wherever it is.
You got to
we'll
do what you
got
to do. I think I'll be unable to speak if I do get the opportunity to meet Tom Brady. Anyway, let's take some more calls. 877-301-8970. What's Butler's first name, the guy that caught the interception?
I don't know.
Yeah, the Butler did it is becoming a theme among the emailers.
Malcolm Butler.
Malcolm
thank you
Butler,
very much.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to Dick in Ashmont. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi, it's Vic, actually.
Oh, Vic, sorry. Well, sorry, yep. Our apologies.
You guys have a great show.
Thank
it's
you.
Very, very educational and very interesting.
Oh,
for,
thank you.
Getting the word out. You guys do fabulous work.
Thanks.
And it's one of the best things in Boston.
You're very nice to say it. Thanks, Vic. What's up?
Well, I have a new, we've heard about Deflategate over and over and over. I have a new take, a new motto would be inflate a pate. In other words, we're all, our pates, our top of our head is all, you know, inflated. With the,
yeah, but Vic, let me explain something to you. If you have to explain a clever thing, don't you think it loses a little bit in the translation?
Well, I know, but this is a generic audience.
We'll consider it, Vic.
I know you guys will get it immediately, but sometimes it takes a little work.
Well, one of us did.
Yeah.
Vic, thank you for your suggestion. We will consider it at the staff meeting. I'm sorry, was there something else?
That was just an aside.
Okay.
The major thing I'm calling about, I called in last week and I missed
sure.
it. because it was at the end of your time frame.
Sure.
A couple of months ago, maybe, a woman called in when we had another snow discussion on the air, and she had lived in Montreal. And I think your producer remembered the call, and the woman described the system that they use for plowing in Montreal, and I think Mr. Dennehy and Mayor Walsh ought to take a look at the way Montreal does snow plowing.
Could you remind us, Vic, what was it? What was it?
All right. What they do is they'll come into a neighborhood with police cars. They will make a PA announcement. In 1 hour, we're going to be plowing this segment of your street. Mm-hmm. Move your car to, you know, some city lot or private lot that's been pre-plowed or whatever. The people have that hour to get their cars out of the district that they're going to plow. Anybody that's not home or can't move the car or whatever, they'll tow it, no penalty, to this other facility short distance away. The plows come in. They plow curb to curb. And the beautiful thing about this is they have bobcats that do the sidewalks at the same time.
Wow, that's great.
That is.
Then they
good.
Bring the cars back, and everybody's happy, and nobody needs a space safe.
Hey, you know, Vic, thanks for it. It's a shame we didn't remember that since it was apparently
Although
here.
You
that
do
it was
wonder how some of these cars, you see them, especially in Boston, where people are on the side streets and they haven't shoveled out their cars yet. How would you even tow a car? You'd have to have the tow drivers would be shoveling for 2 hours themselves to get the car towed out of there. But it is a great idea because that's the problem in all these side streets, right? There's no room.
Yeah. How much you love it? I don't mean this because this is not a sadistic comment like it's going to sound. Mm-hmm. But how great is when you're driving down the street and you see this mound of snow and all you can see is like a doorknob or the mirror coming. I mean, in any case, let's go to Loring, who is in Somerville. You're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up, Loring?
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Regarding the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Yes.
Didn't we all have a little bit of a question after that failed pass, that intercepted pass? I mean, I'm a Patriots fan, but
yeah.
Dave Zirin raised the question about why Marshawn Lynch, one of the most powerful backs in the NFL, was not given the ball. He could have easily taken it across. The coaches sent in a play, and Marshawn Lynch was deprived of his kudos, his honor.
Yeah, well, especially since he didn't have just one opportunity to run a yard. He had at least two, if not three. Yeah. But let me tell you, I have a response to that, and I have to give credit to the source. A friend of mine, Dan Payne, a big-time Democratic consultant, emailed a few minutes ago to say that ESPN is reporting that Lynch, as great as he is, ran the ball five times from the one-yard line this season. Guess how many times he scored? I would have guessed five. Do you know what the answer is, Loring?
None.
One.
Really?
So maybe, despite everybody saying, all the experts last night, that this is the beast, as he's called. And by the way, he's a beast in more than one way. His treatment of the press was just
This is the guy that won't talk to anybody.
Yeah, and ridiculed.
Did you see Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, I know. But in any case, so maybe that's great. But Loring, I think the conventional wisdom is the coach for the offense is never going to have a job again after that. So
yeah.
You may be right. Loring, thank you for the call.
Every time they ask a question, I'm only here because I don't want to get fined.
And it's funny.
I'm only here.
It's funny like once. But a lot of sports reporters who, while I am contemptuous of the fact that they sycophantically refer, if that's a word, to Bob Kraft as Mr. Kraft, what they should have done in this circumstance with this, I would argue, abusive player is don't go to his press conference. Don't go there. Don't ask him stupid questions to which he can give completely unresponsive, insulting answers.
Sheila just emailed. She's not
What'd
a fan
say?
Of Mr. Kraft either.
What she said?
She wanted to know if Mr. Kraft mentioned Mrs. Kraft at all, but she didn't. I don't think he did.
Mrs. Kraft,
the late Meyer Kraft, and one of the previous Super Bowls. Remember, they were wearing
M's or something.
Yeah,
right,
in memory
her.
Of. And she was a wonderful philanthropist.
I met her once. She was an incredible
human
being.
She was a real deal. And but on the other hand, I didn't see the woman whose name escapes me that he's been squiring about.
I don't know either.
I didn't see
you know, one
either.
Thing, by the way, Shira Springer at the end of the show, the last 20 minutes, will be with us. Obviously, he's a great sports writer for the Boston Globe. We're going to talk more about the Super Bowl with her. And one of the questions we're going to drill down on is the whole the Mr. Kraft thing. I don't know what it is. You know how you have an obsession with something? It's not that big a deal. I can't get it out of my...
You are clearly obsessed. And hopefully, Shira Springer can give us some answers about this. That's Bob in Charlestown. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Bob.
Hi.
Hi.
a comment or a question for the mayor. I see in the papers that he is taking a new interest in the issue of parking and residential permits and the whole business of cars in general in the city, which I approve of. I think it's a, you know, it's the right direction.
Yeah.
I have a car. I would be more than happy not to use it or even sell it if public transportation were better.
Exactly.
But the problem we have over here in Charlestown, I live in the Navy Yard,
mm-hmm.
is that the BRA has relocated the MBTA shuttle boat ramp from Pier 4 over to Pier 3.
Bob, I'm only interrupting you. I'm only interrupting you because we were talking about the Super Bowl. I mean, do you have...
I know, I'm sorry. Yes.
The mayor will be here in a month, though. We'll remember the question.
Okay.
Well, I heard the mayor on there.
Oh, no, that was the governor, actually.
But you have anything, you want to say anything about the Super Bowl before we wrap this up, Bob?
Well, I think it's the most amazing Super Bowl that I have ever seen. I've seen most of them. I'm old enough to have seen most of them.
Yeah, it was pretty, it was wonderful.
Two evenly matched teams. Yeah. When you come down to the last seconds and the last play or two, clearly both teams We're world-class teams, and that's the way a great game ends.
Okay. We're going to report that to the mayor, too.
I was as shocked as anyone else when it happened.
Okay, that is a great way to end the segment, Bob, and we'll keep the question in mind about the parking situation. I'm with you. There's no place to park now. I don't know where we're going to make even fewer spots than we already have. Anyway, up next, our television expert, Bob Thompson, joins us for his take on the biggest television event of the year. That, of course, is yesterday's Super Bowl Sunday. Forget about the Patriots. Who were last night's big TV winners and losers? Best ads and worst? We're going to talk about all that up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A study out of the Media Education Foundation says that out of last night's four-hour Super Bowl broadcast, we saw about 17 and a half minutes of football. So how did the other 223 and a half minutes stack up? Actually, it's 222 and a half stack up. Joining us online for his take is Bob Thompson. Bob is the founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hey there, Bob.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Hi, Bob. So before we get to discussing the Super Bowl, we just have to establish your bona fides here. Do you hate the New England Patriots like everybody else outside of Boston, or are you a Pats fan?
No, I was neutral on both of those teams last night.
Okay. All right. So you can give us
Didn't
your
sound own. Very persuasive
you can
to
give
me.
Bear in mind, I live not too far from Buffalo, so we have some Super Bowl issues in upstate New York.
Oh, okay. Okay. So do we know yet how many people watched this thing last night?
I have not seen numbers yet, but they should be out very shortly. It's been hovering around as high as 111 million. They're expecting over 100 million. That's a big audience for the 21st century.
Wow, that is huge. And, you know, we have to talk ads, of course. Do you have any favorites from last night? I thought there were a lot of great ones.
Well, what surprised me, I guess it shouldn't have surprised me, but as I was watching the Super Bowl, the phenomenon now is that seen that one, already seen that one.
Yeah.
I mean, this used to be, talking about Super Bowl commercials was a Monday morning activity, and everybody'd be abuzz about all the funny or sentimental or whatever things that they'd seen. That the one that won the USA Today ad meter, the Budweiser Lost Dog, had been seen 42 million times before the game even started.
Okay, that is a great ad. If people haven't seen it, and probably, obviously, many people have, what Bob just said, but I hadn't. It's a little lab puppy that gets lost, and they're all upset, and they're putting up the guys putting up the lost dog posters, and you see the little dog running through the countryside. Then you see him coming, trying to get home. And then you see a wolf about to attack him. And then you see the Budweiser Clydesdales come roaring up and rescue the little puppy from this wolf and then escort him back home to his owner. I was in tears.
Hey, Bob, Marjorie's got a 10-pound dog, so you should understand the bias that precedes
That wolf that was after that puppy, too, was made the one on Big Bad Wolf. I mean, it was drooling.
Drooling.
That was one scary-looking wolf.
Yeah. Now, I hesitate to ask this question because there's a takeoff on that ad. I don't know if you saw it, the GoDaddy ad.
Yeah.
And Marjorie will be sensitive to this, but for those who didn't see it, similarly, there's a pickup truck out of which a little tiny fluffy dog bounces out. Makes its way home, and we're all weeping. And the woman says something like, "Thank God you made it home, because I just put you on the web and I'm selling you." And that's the end of the
gets put into a box.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
to be shipped off.
Sent off again.
I thought it was fabulous. You can break the tie here, Bob.
Well, okay, that was a and what's so interesting is you can now start having conversations among Super Bowl commercials because they play early and you know what the other person is doing. They got a little more than they bargained for. GoDaddy is not they're perfectly capable of putting up a preview of a Super Bowl ad that they have every intention of pulling just so that when they pull it, 10 million more people will watch it. However, I'm not sure that was the case this time because public relations rule number one is you don't mess with puppies. And a bunch of people, not that puppies aren't being sold every day and there's breeders operating all over the place. Many people have puppies that they've purchased. An awful lot of people somehow thought that ad was a great advocacy for puppy mills, and they got a lot of grief for that. But that very creative ad was replaced by one of the, not only GoDaddy's most boring ads, but one of the most boring ads of the entire Super Bowl.
What was that?
GoDaddy was about people who had to work during the Super Bowl.
That
wasn't that funny or sentimental or interesting on any level.
I thought the GoDaddy ad, too. My reaction was, forget them. I wouldn't get close to them with a 10-foot pole after I saw them, what I thought was being mean.
It was funny.
Mean.
Come on.
It was mean.
You know,
the
other thing about ads, and maybe my television memory is obviously nowhere near what yours is, I don't remember there being as many political ads or political, you know, message kinds of ads. And the one that everybody's talking about, particularly in light of the domestic violence problems with a couple of the players in the league, here's an ad last night that a lot of people are discussing.
Operator 901, where's the emergency?
127, bring me.
Okay, what's going on there?
I'd like to order a pizza for delivery.
Ma'am, you've reached 911. This is an emergency line.
Large with half pepperoni, half mushroom.
You know you've called 911. This is an emergency line.
Do you know how long it'll be?
Okay, ma'am, is everything okay over there? Do you have an emergency or not?
Yes.
And you're unable to talk because...
Right, right.
Okay, is there someone in the room with you? Just say yes or no.
Yes.
Okay, it looks like I have an officer about a mile from your location. Are there any weapons in your house?
No.
Can you stay on the phone with me?
No. See you soon. Thank you.
You know, Bob, I thought that was really powerful
until
I Googled it and then realized that it was a real call, which made it even more powerful. Was that there purely because the NFL is trying to do a CYA thing, or what's that about?
Well, I think definitely after the year the NFL has had, they want to come out looking like they really care about this domestic violence issue. And, in fact, that ad was not only about, obviously, against domestic violence, but it was about listening to people who talk about how they've got domestic violence problems. It was a very artistic commercial. I mean, it starts and you don't really know what's going on, and you hear this weird dissonance between 911 and someone ordering a pizza. If you really thought about that ad, I think it was a very interesting and compelling one. I'm just not so sure that people at a Super Bowl party context who are listening over shouts and microwaves beeping and all the rest of it, that most people are engaged intellectually enough to really get what that ad was trying to do, because it was a fairly complex advertisement.
Well, if people didn't see it, you heard the conversation on the 911 between the woman and the dispatcher, and then they're showing pictures of the house in total disarray, things thrown around, the rugs upended, all the stuff upended. And, I don't know, because the Super Bowl party I was at, I didn't even see it during during the game. And I think that happens a lot where you use it the does. Ads to, like, everybody's going to refill their beer or get some more nachos or whatever.
Or martinis, or, in your case.
Yeah, martinis,
go ahead,
that's right.
You.
But
Or put more dog food in that lovely yeah. dog of yours' dish.
Exactly. But I did think it was so effective because it showed a situation I think people don't think of. You know, people always say, well, why didn't she get out of there?
I
or
totally
why didn't
agree.
She run or something? And you see that obviously she was trying to save herself in a very clever way. And it also gave you newfound respect for the dispatchers because, you know, we hear a lot of stories about dispatchers dismissing people. So I love that angle, too, that the dispatcher got it, you know?
Yeah, I think it was a wonderfully executed commercial. I'm just not sure the context. Not that it was inappropriate. It was perfectly appropriate to put that in the middle of a Super Bowl, which is run by the NFL, which has got a lot of bad history in this. So I think the context of when it was played, I'm just not sure how many people were really getting all of that you just pointed out. I knew that commercial was coming because, once again, it was one I was able to preview 5 days ahead of time, at least.
You know, this is more for Marjorie than Bob, but you may know this too. Remember the whole thing 10 or 15 years ago that the report, and I use the term advisedly, that there was more domestic violence during the Super Bowl than any time? Then it was Christina Hoff Sommers, who we've both interviewed in the past, who came out with a study to debunk it. Where did the truth end up lying, Marjorie? Do you know, or Bob, do you know?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I know that it is not the most.
But it is not the most. Okay.
No, it is not the most. That was a myth that was repeated over and over again. You know, one other ad I wanted to ask you about, Bob, and I'm embarrassed to say I don't even know what product this was advertising, but it was the Make Safe Happen ad where it had this little
Nationwide Insurance.
Okay, yeah. Nationwide Insurance. Thank you very much. That's a bad sign that you saw the ad. You don't know what the company that was trying to advertise. But it was kind of a creepy ad, if you ask me. It had this little boy, you know, in a little tuxedo saying, I'm never going to grow up and get married, and he's never going to do and finish all these other things in his life because he dies in an accident. And then they show a bathtub filled with water, and you presume the little boy was, you know, drowned in the bathtub, or a flat screen TV on the floor, presuming the kid was crushed by the television. I mean, this was a devastating ad.
It really was. I mean, and it was, if by far the lost puppy was the hands down winner of most loved of all the commercials, this was by far the most controversial and talked about, and most of it was negative. And you're right. This kid is saying all the things he's never going to do. And then, like, what was that movie, The Sixth Sense? All of a sudden, out of the blue, he's not going to do them because he's dead. And you're right. Here's this overflowing bathtub. And there's a couple of things about that. Number one, I'm not really sure how effective that commercial would be in any context. I mean, yes, we'd want our children to be safe, and I guess putting a bike and a bathtub and a TV there maybe makes you think about that. By the way, no firearms that I was able to see in that commercial.
No, I don't think so, no.
A cause of a lot of household accidents. So I'm not even sure how good of a commercial it was, period. And it certainly was a kind of a hit or slap in the face in the middle of Super Bowl, especially this particular Super Bowl where I swear I thought it was Father's Day, not Super Bowl Sunday. You could not blink your eyes without some incredibly sentimental minute, 90 seconds of fathers doing all these wonderful things with their children. And then a tear always at the end as they go off with their backpack.
But speaking of children, I wasn't going to bring this one up since you were talking about family. That Like a Girl thing that was, it was an ad for Always. I thought was terrific, even though I think I've seen a variation on that. The only reason I brought it up is there's a great line from someone, and I can't credit it because I don't know who said it, who said we're wasting our best filmmakers on tampon ads, which I thought was a pretty good line. What's that?
You're right. The Super Bowl advertisements are a film festival. These are not so much about selling products as the creative teams getting to show off. And as we've already pointed out today, oftentimes you don't even remember what it's for. That was a very nice, I think, sweet, good message. And it was almost when that Always popped up, a little bit of a punchline. In the room I was watching, there were a couple of, not nasty laughing, but a couple of snickers, just because you didn't really see that coming unless you'd seen it previewed, mm-hmm. which, of course, it also had been previewed days before.
Yeah, once again, I don't remember. Was it a public service thing? Was there a company?
Like a Girl?
Yeah.
Always, the tampon
always,
thing. I wasn't joking.
Feminine
at the end,
yeah.
it just comes
it
up on the screen.
It was a tampon ad?
I don't know if it's a tampon ad. It's sponsored by a tampon. That was why I read the quote, Marjorie.
I didn't get why you read the quote, because I didn't know, once again, the company.
And the interesting thing is the Always logo pops up right after a very young, obviously prepubescent young girl does this very sweet quote about how running like a girl is running as fast as you can.
Yeah, it was great.
And all of a sudden, this product for adult women pops up. That was a little weird, but I think that got number two on the USA Today ad meter.
I thought it was great.
Okay, so what got number one?
Budweiser.
I think they
got it for a puppy last year. Put those Clydesdales in a puppy and make sure the puppy doesn't get put in a box and sold, and you're fine.
I love that ad. Okay, let's move on to the halftime show. Katy Perry, of course, was the star of the halftime show, riding into the stadium on some ridiculous looking. What the hell?
Oh, the
was
production
that
was
to
great.
Be?
Even
oh,
if you're
my
not
God.
A
mechanical person. Lion, or a tiger, I believe, given the lyrics of the song.
Yeah, well, I thought it was horrible. Jim thought it was great. So, Bob, tell us what you thought about the halftime show.
Well, I'm going to go with you on this one. Every 2 years, I guess, we get to see this stuff on Olympic opening ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
And it always seems like the Super Bowl halftime show is picking up the leftover hardware from the Olympic ceremony that went before. But it was a perfectly – that was kind of a cool mechanical puppet tiger protected by the ninjas who were making it work. And the way they have those little digital three-dimensional whatever stuff, it was a perfectly competent halftime show. I have to say, though, of the three things going on Super Bowl Sunday, the football game, the halftime show, and the advertising film festival, I usually choose halftime as the time I go to the bathroom and, you know,
me
get
too.
My breath and all the rest of it. And then if something exciting happens, I watch it the next day on my TiVo.
Okay, let's move on to non-Super Bowl news. This is a classic Eddie Murphy scene. He's playing a ghettoized spoof of Mr. Rogers, Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood. And there is a little offensive language, so if you want to walk away from the radio, so be it. Here it is.
Hello, boys and girls. We're all alone again today. You know why? My wife walked out on me. Isn't that nice? I'm so glad the bitch is gone. Who could that be? Let's see. This is how you answer a door in my neighborhood.
Who is it?
It's Mr. Landlord. Hello, Mr. Landlord.
Your rent's 6 months overdue. It's a summons.
Oh, look. An eviction notice. Brought by Mr. Landlord. Can you say scum bucket? That's our special word for today, boys and girls.
By the way, that was long, but we played it because I love that bit. 31 years since a guy who essentially grew up on Saturday Night Live, or at least became famous on SNL, 31 years, and he's returning for, what, the 40th anniversary or something?
They are promoting the living daylights out of, including in the Super Bowl. There must have been six spots for that, it seemed like.
So was this self-imposed exile, or why has he been away so long? Or he didn't need it, or what's the deal?
Well, he was – there was kind of a feud going on. He left during the season 9, I think it was. And then he came back and hosted in December of 84, so 30 years ago. And then they started, there was a few, I think it was a David Spade joke about how David Spade held up a picture of Eddie Murphy or something and said, look, kids, a falling star or something Oof. Like that. Murphy came out and said he hadn't liked that, and he kind of groused about Saturday Night Live a lot. And I think now probably, you know, it's 30 years ago for him. The show's been on for 40 years. It's a feud that probably no longer is holding much of its heat. But I don't think there was a lot of love lost between Eddie Murphy and Saturday Night Live when he left that show.
I'm thrilled, actually, that he's coming back for this thing. And even though it is over-advertised, I'm dying to see it.
So
I don't know how that – I think that special's only 3 hours long. It seems like they're going to need a lot longer than that.
So we're talking with Bob Thompson, our TV guru from Syracuse University. Bob, we're going to ask our listeners about this in a few minutes. So we wanted to get your take before we do. A new study linking binge watching of television to depression, that people that watch it are very lonely and depressed, and they get through their depressive hours by just watching one television show after another.
I'm not lonely and depressed.
Jim is not lonely and depressed, and he's a big binge watcher, so he thinks it's a bunch of baloney. And by the way, in the study, they say that they define binge watching as one says four in a row. I think you got to go to at least six in a row, but what do I know? What do you think about
this? I think you got to do a whole season to call it a real man.
Amen. You go.
Yeah. So do you think this is just more psychobabble coming from the people getting grants to do these kind of studies, or do you think that people like Jim have a problem and they need to shrink immediately?
Well, the last thing I think is self-evident, but I don't think it's got anything to do with binge-watching. No, I'm just kidding, Jim.
Go ahead.
It's not complete. I mean, it's not complete babble. It's a correlation between the two. And I guess to some extent, some of this is common sense. If you are really depressed and things aren't going well, the idea of parking yourself in front of the TV and binge watching for a bunch of hours almost seems like a natural sort of thing to do. I mean, watching TV a lot when you're depressed seems a common way. You're not having to deal with other people. It's an escapist and all of that kind of thing. And then it also says things like, problems such as obesity and other problems are related to binge watching. Well, that's probably common sense as well. If you're binge watching a lot, it means you're sitting down, you're probably eating in front of the TV. Where I think we have to be careful is making the connection that somehow one of these causes the other as opposed to is correlated.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure a lot of people binge watch when they're depressed. And I'm sure there are some people who, after a lot of binge-watching, may feel depressed. But that doesn't mean that one causes the other. There's a lot of other binge-watchers who don't feel depressed. They feel really invigorated when they're watching their favorite shows. And the same is true with the obesity thing. If all you do is watch television, obesity is probably going to be a factor in your life. But it's got nothing to do with television making you obese. It's got to do with the fact that you never get up and move. So I'm wary of this addiction thing, and I think I've got a line of this. Even though some people argue that binge watching is a harmless addiction, findings from our studies suggest that binge watching should no longer be viewed this way. That's right from the report. To put television viewing in the same category as alcohol, tobacco, those kinds of things, I think is really a mistake. Television viewing may indirectly become a public health issue, but it's really got nothing to do with television. It's got to do with behaviors of people that television happens to be part of.
I have five words to respond to that. Let House of Cards begin.
Okay.
Okay, Bob Thompson. We decided starting last week, because we don't want to leave people on a down note, we're going to do worst of the week and then best. What's worst?
Well, I have to say, and this, I guess, is still Super Bowl themed, the 5,000 easy jokes that comedians did about the deflated balls of the New England Patriots.
I couldn't
agree
more.
The first couple were funny enough, but, oh, man, that was such low-hanging fruit. I got tired after about the 500th.
Okay, well, speaking of 500th, you're going to hear 504 more. Here is Chelsea's pulled together some of the worst, a montage of late-night deflate jokes. Here they are.
11 of the 12 footballs provided by the Patriots in Sunday's AFC Championship game were underinflated by 2 pounds, which for a football or an Olsen twin, that is a lot. So
the balls we practice with are as bad as they can be. Wet, sticky, cold, slippery.
Sticky. That's also the most popular line from the 50 Shades of Grey movie that's coming out. Same line.
Attorney Gloria Allred is now representing 9 of the 11 balls Tom Brady allegedly squeezed.
The amount this week that the inflation or deflation of balls is in the news. I wake up every morning wishing I was still 9 years old.
By the way, all three of us were laughing despite agreeing with you enough was enough.
Especially the Gloria Allred line. I love that one. Yeah. That was pretty funny. Okay, that was the worst. Okay, so if that was the worst, what was, Bob Thompson, the best?
Well, it seems like around about Super Bowl time is also when the thaw of all the holiday reruns and everything's been put on hold while people are out Christmas and New Year's and everything. And the return of the ABC lineup on Thursday, what they're calling TGIT.
Oh,
this
yes.
is the night that Shonda Rhimes shows goes all 3 hours. And Scandal and How to Get Away with Murder, I still like to celebrate whenever I can because they are just so much fun, good old-fashioned nighttime soaps, and they're playing on broadcast TV. They don't have the advantage of being on AMC or Amazon or HBO or whatever. And in some ways, they're still among the most fun television shows, if not the most literate. So they've returned this Thursday.
We've got a little clip from the trailer of the new season of Scandal, so let's play it for people right now.
My name is Olivia Pope. I have been taken against my will. You must declare war within the next 48 hours. Refuse, and I will be killed.
Wow. That's
a subtle plot point, isn't it?
Yeah, quite dramatic. So we should all be tuning into this.
Yeah, well, and if you haven't yet, I'd recommend starting from the very beginning because that show got off running several seasons ago and has had some very fine moments. So start at the beginning unless you're worried about that binge viewing report have yourself a grand old time.
You know what the thing is, Bob Thompson? You hear people talking about these TV shows. Like Jim has been talking for years about Homeland, and I had never watched Homeland. So over Christmas vacation when I had some time, I binge-watched Homeland with one of my kids. And, you do get snatched up. You find yourself up until 2 o'clock in the morning watching these shows. And they're right when they say you don't do anything else because you don't sleep to watch these things. But it was fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. They are. But I think the words I just heard is huge fun. When you're in a show that's really good and you're completely engaged in it, there is nothing quite like that.
Yeah.
I think the closest thing is if you ever find yourself at 3 o'clock in the morning and you're still reading a book even though you got to get up in 3 hours. Huge fun, I think, is about as good a way to describe it as all. However, if you're binge-watching and you're enjoying it so much that you fail to go to work or you fail to get your kid out to the bus stop or that kind of thing, then you have a problem. But I don't know that problem is television's problem or even binge viewing problem. I think that's a problem much more deeper seated, that you simply don't know how to quit watching, quit doing something to go do what you have to do.
Well, I couldn't disagree with you more. I think the kids got to learn to go to the bus by themselves. Anyway, Bob, and it's enough. Bob Thompson, it is a joy as always. Have a good week.
Thank you so
you
much,
too.
Bob.
Thank you.
Bob Thompson is the founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. He joins us every Monday. Bob, great to talk to you. Coming up, we're going to ask you guys how you feel about binge-watching television. A new study says that binge-watching is linked to depression and loneliness. Do you think you are a binge-aholic? That's coming up on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Just heard about the blizzard, and we're going to talk about that in about 15 or 20 minutes with you. But first, if you're just joining us, we were talking to Bob Thompson from Syracuse about binge viewing. There's a new study that suggests that people who gorge themselves on multiple TV episodes in one sitting, otherwise known as binge viewing, might be doing it to, quote, cope with feelings of depression and loneliness. We don't know if this rings true for you. Have you found yourself binging on TV one night, only to wake up with a television hangover the next? Or is TV just an easy target? Is it true that all things should be done in moderation? I would say absolutely no, Marjorie. I would say I'm not depressed as far as I know. I don't wake up particularly lonely and horrified by the day ahead of me. Binge viewing, not only binge viewing itself, but the anticipation of binge viewing of a show that I either love or I've heard wonderful things about is as exciting as anything. Now, do you know what the number one binge viewing show is of them all? You probably could guess.
Would it be Breaking Bad?
That's what it is. Let's play a little scene to get you in the mood. Here is the great Breaking... It makes me almost weep when I think that it's gone. Here's Hank, the brother-in-law, starting to catch on to Walter's, well, you know, his meth operation. Here it is.
To WW, my star, my perfect silence. WW. I mean, who do you figure that is, huh? Woodrow Wilson? Willy Wonka? Walter White? You got me.
Oh, my God. 877-301-8970. Where is binge viewing in your life? Now, you're fairly new to this thing, are you not?
Yes, I binged watched over Christmas vacation.
You did, and what did you watch? You were just telling Bob Thompson.
Homeland.
Yeah. How many seasons did you watch?
I'm caught up. I've watched all four seasons.
Now, my expectation is, do you know when House of Cards, which is tied for number two, the most binge-watched show, on February 27th, the whole season becomes available.
Yeah.
I intend to watch, I don't know if it's, I think it's 13 episodes, I'm not sure. I intend to watch all 13 episodes, maybe with a quick trip to the bathroom, right in succession. And I not only don't plan to be depressed, I plan to be exhilarated by the brilliant acting, great stories, great, it's just fabulous.
I don't know, there's something to me a little weird about 6 hours of television in a row.
What's weird about it?
I just think it's odd. I mean, you go to the average movie, what is it, 2.5 hours, something
like that. And it
takes
you a half hour to get there, and
that's
you park, so it's another half hour.
All right, so that's that
4 hours.
Runs up being about 3.5 hours,
fine.
Actually, not to be technical about it. Same thing with you go to the theater, you go to the museum. Mm-hmm. There's something odd about 6 hours. I mean, I can see if it's sort of a family thing, everybody's all excited, mm-hmm. and they gather around, they watch it, and all that, but these people are sitting alone. There's a great picture in the story about the binge-watching depressed people. Some kid looks like he's about 20 years old, collapsed on the couch with his clicker in his hand, looking like a zombie, dazed over. I think there's a lot of this going on, and I think it's kind of weird. And I think it also, if you happen to be, you know, a regular person that isn't like suffering from depression necessarily, but it's sort of an easy way to kind of avoid having to go out and, you know, find out what's going on, get out of your house and go see the movie, or go out for a drink with friends, or go somewhere. Mm-hmm. You can become very passive.
You know what? It's another easy way too. To have huge fun. That's what 877-301-897. I think Bob Thompson hit the nail on the head. There's no question that some people who do this binge watching thing do it to avoid the world, to not deal with their problems.
A lot of people do it alone.
Are depressed, but is there a causal connection?
I
don't buy that. I'm
sorry. I think it's weird to be sitting by yourself.
You think binge viewing causes that, or you think it's a person who's feeling depressed?
I don't think you should be doing it so much by yourself. If you're doing it in groups, it's different. But to be sitting around by yourself, binge watching these TV shows. No, I don't mean to hurt your feelings, Jim. Yeah. Maybe you're doing it as a group family activity.
No, I'm not.
Which is
actually
different.
I'm not at all. Let me ask you the question.
What?
I don't mean to get personal. What do you have better to do than watch 13 straight hours of House of Cards when it comes out on February? What are you going to be doing on February 27th?
That's the other thing.
That's better than that.
When I was binge watching House of Cards, you know, what they do so brilliantly is the last show runs into the second one. So unless you turn off your computer or click off the Netflix site, it just starts. So all of a sudden, you look, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and you've been watching television since 10 o'clock, and you know, you have to get up the next morning. So I can see where it becomes people can become a binge-aholic. Jim, I think you should be aware, because I think you're in a borderline situation.
I also want to correct a misconception about binge viewing, because I consider myself a bit of an expert on this. The theory is the only shows that are good for binge viewing are those that have where the prior show has a connection other than the cast to the next show. Like House of Cards is a continuing drama. Do you know when I binge watched that was as much fun as anything? Veep with Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Oh, yeah.
They're like 25 minutes long or 26 minutes long. HBO, a brilliant comedy about Julia Louis-Dreyfus as vice president. It's just, it's fabulous. It is a great way to spend, it's a great way to spend time.
Okay, Judith said she accidentally gave herself bursitis by binge-watching 14 straight episodes of House of Cards. I thought there were only 13. I've been standing while watching television ever since, including the Super Bowl. Judith, I hope you feel better.
877-301-8970. What prompted this is not the fact that House of Cards is 25 days away.
Not that you're counting or anything.
I am, but what prompted it is that there's a study again. It says gorging oneself on multiple TV episodes in one sitting, the definition of binge viewing, might be doing it to, quote, cope with feelings of depression and loneliness. They might, but it's not causing, in my opinion, depression and loneliness. Well, also, it's one of the outlets for people who are depressed and lonely. I mean,
if you have a difficulty self-regulating, this story also points out.
What's self-regulating what?
Well, if you have difficulty turning off the television or difficulty...
The show's good. Of course you have difficulty turning it off.
Exactly. Well, if you are one of those people and you have a show that just rotates, right, episode rotates right into the next one, you're going to have real trouble, Jim. And instead of being up until 2 o'clock in the morning, you'd be up till 5 o'clock in the morning.
I want to say one last thing, and I'd ask you not to respond to it because it's a sad story, so we shouldn't get into the details. But this is prior to binge viewing. Do you remember the story of the woman from the Midwest who sat on the couch for so long that she started her skin and the couch... started melting.
Yes, I do.
Okay, let's leave that. 877. That was horrible. Why'd you bring it up? 877.
You know what she was doing, Jim?
I do. Well, I don't talk about it.
She was binge watching.
She was. No, that was prior to binge watching, Marjorie. 877-301-8970. Where are you in the binge watch? Oh, did I read these statistics before we start? No, I did not. 80%. Where is it? Here it is. 80% of Americans who use the internet, which I assume is probably 80 or 90%, I don't know, watch TV on their own schedule. 62% of Americans, according to the Harris people, you know, Harris research people, reported that they watch multiple episodes of a TV show in succession. As you said to Bob Thompson a few minutes ago, according to these studies, how many was it watching two in a row as binge viewing, which is ridiculous?
Well, there's a dispute about that. Some people think two in a row, that's ridiculous. I think that four in a row is if you're going to talk about binging, I think you have to go for at least four. And by the way, the people that are doing the most binge watching are kids, 18 to 29-year-olds. They're the ones, and young adults, college kids and young adults. Imagine if you're paying $60,000 and you know what your kid is doing is binge watching until 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. That would send me through the roof.
I am paying $60,000 and I know exactly what my kid is doing.
And you know, if you can be, you know, holier than thou or not holier than thou, but be, I always thought it was a bad idea to get televisions for your kids when they go to the way to college and let, and I want the TV in their room.
Sure.
But they don't need the TV in their room. They just have the computer in the room. And that, and they're, so they're sitting there in their bed with whatever else beverage of their choice, binge watching. I don't think that's a good expenditure of your money, Jim.
Okay, now, speaking of young people being the biggest binge watchers, a show that I can just not watch for a minute without turning it off. I happened to tune in during the marriage episode where a number of people lost their lives. The second most popular show to binge view, it's tied. I said House of Cards and Game of Thrones, which is wildly popular, particularly with young people. Here's a little bit of a scene from the very same Game of Thrones. Here it is.
Someone get the girl something to cover herself with.
She's to be your queen. Have you no regard for her honor?
I'm punishing her.
For what crimes? She should not fight her brother's battle, you half-wit.
You can't talk to me like that. The king can do as he likes.
The Mad King did as he liked. Has your Uncle Jamie ever told you what happened to him?
No one threatens his grace in the presence of the King's guard.
I'm not threatening the king, sir. I am educating my nephew. Bronn, the next time Sir Merrin speaks, kill him. That was a threat. See the difference?
So what do you think of that, Marjorie? She'll not fight her brother's battle, you half-wit. 877-301-8970. I hate that show, but I know a lot of young people in particular do. And it's number two on the binge viewing list.
What? Lucy points out, and this is a great point, when you have young kids, and she does, she says what she does is she wants to see Game of Thrones or House of Cards, which is not exactly child viewing appropriate. She binge watches when the kids are off, like at a play date, one's at another's at a birthday party. So she's a few hours by herself in the house when she crams in all the binge watching. I get that completely. But it's a different story when you don't have any young kids and you have no other excuse. 877-301-8970. Let's go to John from Cambridge. Thank you for calling, John.
Hello, John.
Hello.
Hey.
I have a couple of shameful admissions to make.
Go ahead. We're ready.
Well, actually, some of them aren't shameful. I have never binge watched just because I haven't. But I have never watched House of Cards, at least not the American version.
Oh.
I'm a devoted fan of the British version, which, and there's nothing could be better than that. Urquhart is played by a guy named Ian Richardson, who does things with his face and eyes that make him positively into the serpent from the devil's serpent.
Well, let me say two things. First of all, I've seen the British House of Cards. At least, is it a three-episode thing? It's not a huge thing. It's fairly short, isn't it, or is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a part of it, and I liked it. But I have to say, Kevin Spacey, And what's her name? The female lead.
She was married to
Robin Wright.
Robin Wright, thank
are you. So brilliant in this thing, and it is so cleverly written. I mean, it's a satire, obviously. It is, you're missing out, and I would suggest to you that you set aside your evening and next morning on February 27th and 28th, Sean, and not only watch House of Cards, but break your schneid on no binge viewing. Why don't you do any binge viewing, John? What's the reluctance?
I'm not sure I know how to.
Okay.
Okay,
well,
John.
That's the
listen
problem.
To the show. We'll help you out. Thank
but
you, John, for the call.
It's pretty easy because I can do it, and I'm not exactly miss technology. You know, that reminds me of that when The Office started out in Great Britain, mm-hmm. and then it came here, and people thought, oh, it's not nearly as good. But I must say the American version with Steve Carell as the central character, Michael, I love that
but
show.
But isn't Ricky Gervais the –
Ricky Gervais was
who
the
is
original
a
guy
he
in the
is
British
brilliant.
One. It was great, but the American one yeah. – You know, obviously, it's an American Office, and the whole feeling was different. Christopher says the ultimate pleasure in his life is to DVR a couple of weeks of Broadside, the news with Jim Browdy, mm-hmm. then sit down with a big bowl of hummus, carrot sticks, and binge watch.
You know, by the way, I cannot believe that's not my email. It's exactly what I do most weekends. This is incredible. Let's go to Marie in Worcester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Marie.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling... I binge watch once in a while, sometimes by myself, sometimes with other people. But I frequently find that when I do, the characters show up in my dream sometime in the next week or two.
Really?
Ooh.
Yes, and I don't know if anybody else has experienced that. I'd be interested if you had one of your medical or psychological people on the show to run that by them sometimes.
Well, it's not so, when you think about it, I don't know anything about dreams, but it's not that surprising. You think about it. If your waking attention is focused on the same thing for an extended period of time, it's not ridiculous to think that it'll continue into your sleeping hours. No, I don't know.
Yeah, it's almost similar to sometimes if like a new person shows up at work, and I find I have a dream about them maybe 2 or 3 weeks after they've been there. As if my mind is getting used to these new people. And I'm wondering if my mind is trying to get used to these characters.
Let's hope that you don't dream about Walter White, I hope. Who do you dream about? I mean, who do you dream about?
Well, I haven't binged that one. The most recent one I did was The Honorable Woman,
I don't know that. What was that about?
A Jewish family in Great Britain who are trying to sort of help with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Huh.
And there's a lot of political stuff involved and terrorism and things like that.
That's another one for Jim to get involved with then.
Yes, it's called The Honorable Woman. It's very good. Yes.
Okay, Marie, thank you very much for the call. The number is 877-301-8970. Kathleen says, shows like House of Cards, The Wire, and Breaking Bad are so well written and acted, it's like reading a book that you can't put down. But she says, what about binge listening? She binge listened to 12 episodes of Serial, that podcast about the murder over New Year's.
Oh, yes.
And she
says... Oh, that was huge.
And Kathleen, thank you. She binge listens to us every day from 11 to 2. And I guess that would qualify as binge listening if you actually listen for 3 hours.
Well, not to me, it doesn't. But that's a very interesting point. Why, if it's okay and we urge people to listen from 11 to 2 or listen to it at night on Monday through Wednesday, why is that okay? And watching 3 hours of a serial is not okay.
It's the same reason for me why I have the radio on so much in the house.
Environmental thing?
No, because you can do other things. You can clean the kitchen and clean house and change the beds.
Oh, you mean radio versus TV?
Yes, television. You have to sit there and watch it or stand there, I suppose. You're standing now all the time instead of sitting. But you have to look at it, which is obviously different.
You know, the more I think about this, the movie comparison that I made before, I think makes a lot of sense. I don't know, comparison. But you go to a movie,
what
it's 2 hours.
What movie lasts 6 hours, Jim?
No, 2 hours and 15 minutes. And you go, and let's say when you have a meal. You have a meal, so it's a six-hour experience. Is that 5 hours out? You're counting a dinner kind of thing? Well, why is that any different than having a bowl of nachos or something in front of you, and you're sitting on the couch watching five fabulous... And by the way, let me tell you one more thing about binge viewing. Is unlike most television and movie viewing of something new, where you really don't know what to expect. generally the things like Homeland you did because so many people with whom you work said this is really exciting and fun.
That's right.
I didn't watch Breaking Bad, by the way, until Sheila, our regular emailer and friend, said you've got to watch this show. It was maybe halfway through the first season, and then I couldn't stop watching, kind of thing. So, and by the way, I purposely would not. Oh, this is really important, I think.
Okay, Jim.
I would purposely not watch on the night it was on because 58 minutes was not enough for me. So I would suffer through not watching on the night that it was current because I knew that if I resisted and waited till I could watch 3 hours in a row, it was much more pleasurable. Do you know what I mean?
Nancy says she binge watches Breaking Bad for 4 days. She did it. And the same thing for House of Cards. And she says she is happy as a clam.
It's great.
At high tide.
But that's even better. But I'm telling you, there are going to be people. We'll talk about this with Bob Thompson the week that House of Cards is about to go online. And they release, I think it was clear what we said, they release every episode from the season at the exact same time, like 8 o'clock on, I don't know if 27th is a Friday. I'm not sure what day it is. Is 27th a Friday? I think it is. Yeah, I think it is. In any case, and it's exaltation. You plan for it. You watch 4 episodes, then 5. It's just great. I think the whole phenomenon that's relatively recent is just terrific.
Oh, here's a good one. Rosina says it's great when you're recovering from surgery or out sick or you have a neck replacement, knee replacement, something like that.
Well, I haven't had any surgery lately, Marjorie, and I still love it. Let's go to Mary in Brookline. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi.
Hi.
My issue with binge watching is that I feel like I can't think about what happened in the episode. I can't process it emotionally, and which I like. I like the weekly. You know, I get the 1 hour, and it was really intense, and I think about it and talk about it, and then I see the next one. Mm-hmm. So I don't like that part of binge watching. And the other thing is that I want to save it. Like, every Game of Thrones for me is like a piece of candy. I do not want to eat all the candy in one day.
Yeah, that's a point.
Stretch it out.
Yeah, no, that's true. Every time I turn it on, someone's getting guillotined or something.
How'd you like that marriage episode when everybody died? What'd you think of that marriage? That was a fun show, wasn't it?
Well, that was fun, but what would you just go to the next one? Like, we're sitting there like, oh, my God.
That was a tough one. Now, that's a good point. That was a good point. I'm sorry.
Next one.
Yeah. No, you make actually a decent point. It's not something that's going to...
That's what happens. You've gone through, all of a sudden, like I said, you go into like 9 episodes.
She wants to savor it and think about it.
I think savoring and thinking about it is the way to go.
I've never been a savorer or a thinker,
okay.
Marjorie.
That's fine.
I'll stay with binge viewing. Mary, thank you.
Mary, thank
much
you
for
the call.
We appreciate it.
We're going to change gears again because we're going to talk to the Globe's Shira Springer. She joins us for her take on Super Bowl Sunday, and she's going to talk about the pregame show, which I didn't get to see much of, but she's got some spectacular information on the PR campaign the NFL was running all during that pregame show. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 for some Monday afternoon quarterbacking. Is Shira Springer. Shira is an investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Hello, Shira.
Hello.
Well, Shira Springer, I just want to ask you, I ran into you in the green room when I was heating up my coffee, and you were talking about the pregame show, which I did not watch.
Nor did I.
And so tell people that missed it, like Jim and I did, what was the sort of theme that was going on for a lot of that?
Yeah, I tuned in shortly afternoon to sort of settle in for the Super Bowl, and it was all about kids and what a great benefit football was to their lives, and it was about female coaches. They did an incredibly compelling story about a woman, I believe she lives in Virginia or Alabama or South Carolina, who has MS, who was talking about the joy she gets from coaching her kids' football team and how sometimes when she gets bad news from the doctor, she goes to practice and the bad news sort of just washes away because she's so excited to be coaching kids' football. It was a lot about women and kids and women and kids. And I was sitting there thinking, gosh, this is just one straight PR campaign for the NFL who is trying to sort of whitewash its image with regard to women and kids. No mention of concussions and the injuries that are occurring. No mention of the fact that I believe Pop Warner participation is down close to 10% over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, and that they're, you know, they were clearly promoting and campaigning for the benefits to women and kids of football.
Did they mention Ray Rice? And domestic violence?
No. And then it was shortly before the game that they made a passing mention to Deflategate. And I was like, okay, here we go. And again, it was, you know, very much in keeping with the let's just smooth this over and get on to the game.
But there was one thing that happened during the game, mm-hmm. one of the spots. We talked about this an hour ago. I don't know what it was. About what I thought was a really powerful public service announcement about domestic violence. Let's hear it again if we can. Here it is.
Operator 901, where's the emergency?
127, bring me.
Okay, what's going on there?
I'd like to order a pizza for delivery.
Ma'am, you've reached 911. This is an emergency line.
Large with half pepperoni, half mushroom.
You know you've called 911. This is an emergency line.
Do you know how long it'll be?
Okay, ma'am, is everything okay over there? Do you have an emergency or not?
Yes.
And you're unable to talk because...
Right.
Okay, is there someone in the room with you? Just say yes or no.
Yes.
Okay, it looks like I have an officer about a mile from your location. Are there any weapons in your house?
No.
Can you stay on the phone with me?
No. See you soon. Thank you.
So the NFL, and I'm no fan of how they handled this domestic violence thing, apparently teamed up with this No More Listen group, mm-hmm. No More Colon mm-hmm. Listen group to do. And by the way, it was a real phone call, as we mentioned before. That was about as powerful as it gets.
And what was really powerful, too, is that while this conversation was going on, they were showing the house that had been
completely torn apart.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And you see the last shot is this, a framed picture of a woman who's likely, we're led to believe, is the woman who's making this phone call, smashed, shattered by a trash can.
Yeah, it was a really powerful ad, which I was saying before, during the game, I didn't even see because I was either running out to the bathroom or to get something to eat or whatever, but I saw it this morning and it was fantastic.
We want to get to the joys of the game in a minute, but staying on the issues you raised, which are the real world issues, I only saw some excerpts of the press conference from the $800,000 a week commissioner of the National Football League. You know, one of the things that drives me nuts, by the way, is it was on TV here while we were on the air, so I couldn't listen to most, so I heard some clips after. The 45 minutes I was half watching, the guy smiled not once. And, you know, you shouldn't smile during questions about Deflategate or domestic violence or concussions. The lack of joy in a lot of the managers of this sport is unbelievable to me. But my question is, did he in his, what was it, Friday or whatever press conference was, did he confront any of these issues in a meaningful way?
No. He was asked about Deflategate. He was asked,
how about concussion? We had Chris Nowinski. I don't know if he was Friday or Thursday or whatever, who obviously from the Sports Legacy Institute at BU, former pro wrestler, former All-Ivy football player, who's done as much on concussions as about anybody on the planet. Do they just try to
gloss over it? Yeah. I mean, I've seen three separate Goodell press conferences sort of over Super mm-hmm. Bowl weekend or prior to Super Bowl weekend. Then there was one this morning where he spoke as well. And I don't remember him discussing in any great depth any of the major issues, you know, whether it's Ray Rice and domestic abuse, concussions, or even Deflategate. They sort of all had, and this goes through the Patriots and, you know, through NFL brass, a standard response to Deflategate, which was, you know, we're investigating, you know, this does, it will determine, you know, what the effect is on legacy once the investigation is done, nothing in depth.
You wonder who's giving advice to this guy, because it seems to me, again, I didn't see most of it. You open the thing by saying, in a couple of minutes, I'm going to talk about the joy that we're all going to experience this weekend. But I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the darker side and talk about Rice.
Yeah.
By the way, then you not only is it brilliant because you show you theoretically care, even if you don't, but then you preempt a lot of the questions or conversation. Then you can go on to say, boy, is this great. Tom Brady's back for the sixth time, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It is. Almost as if they think, well, I guess we're part of the problem too, Pogo-esque fashion.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't mention it, then we won't mention it. And then we just love the game, which all of us did. One of the greatest games ever.
As much as I like the fact that they, you know, paid for this commercial and, you know, it was front and center during the Super Bowl and everybody heard it. And there was a lot of publicity about it before the Super Bowl, before it even aired. So it got a lot of play. I still think there should have been. You have a six-hour pregame show.
That's true.
I think there
is
should
it 6 hours?
It's 6 hours.
It started
from
at noon
to six.
You didn't watch all six hours.
No, I did not watch all six. But I think, you know, but I didn't hear of anything where I think there should have been a sit-down interview with Goodell and others who are either involved in the concussion issue,
totally.
Others involved with – you had the time to do it. I'm happy you gave an ad to the No More organization and you're raising awareness. But there – and I understand that it's a game, and I understand the focus is on having a good time and Katy Perry and yay, rah, rah, and fireworks and, you know, Las Vegas-style entertainment. I get that. But you had plenty of time to devote to a couple of serious issues.
Okay, well, there's a very, very serious issue. I think perhaps as serious as anything we discussed today, which also obsesses Jim Browdy. And
also,
maybe you can weigh in on this.
It's my prime
one,
obsession.
Is why is it that everyone calls Mr. Kraft Mr. Kraft? Is this an edict from Mr. Kraft? Or is this just that for some reason sports reporters are not calling him Mr. Belichick and Mr. Brady?
I have no idea. Whenever I call for an interview, and I've called a few times for an interview, it's been Robert. Stacey
you probably
James.
Don't get an interview then.
No, I am. I've got a couple. I've been to the office, the sanctum, the inner sanctum, and then seen sort of his array of interesting, eclectic memorabilia from various games and also from music concerts. He's very good friends with Elton John. So there's
he is.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he has some connection there.
So at the interviews, do you say Mr. Kraft or do you say Robert?
I say Robert. I mean,
and he doesn't flinch?
He does not flinch.
You are totally the outlier, by the way.
Maybe.
I am telling you, I am a student of this.
Yes.
And some sports columnists, reporters, whom I really admire, do this Mr. Kraft thing. As I, you know, there are little things, and I shouldn't be this obsessed with this, and then we're going to get to the celebration in about 30 seconds. It drives me out. They don't show
much
respect for the president of the Senate,
Stacey James, the PR person for the Patriots, always calls him Robert on the phone with me, so I call him Robert. I don't know why others call him Mr. Kraft.
Can you do a piece on it, please, and get in the
I'll get right on it.
Thank
investigate
you.
Okay,
that.
So let's
okay.
get to some fun
yes.
stuff. Tell us about Tom Brady. Now, where does he rank in the annals of great quarterbacks of all time?
Isn't the conversation over? He's the greatest ever.
I was going to say, if you live in New England, then the conversation is over. He has four Super Bowl titles. That ties him with Joe Montana and Terry Bradshaw of the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Doesn't he have to beat them?
One would think. I was going to say, so if you're in New England, I think you put Tom Brady at the top of the list. If you're living near the Pittsburgh area, you put Terry Bradshaw. And I think Terry Bradshaw won his four within 6 years.
Yeah.
And, if you're living in the Bay Area where Brady is from, you might make a case for Joe Montana and the way he led the 49ers. I think, obviously, if he gets one more Super Bowl win, then he is unquestionably the greatest of all time. I think he can still make a case for that. Right now, I think it's actually impressive that his four Super Bowl wins have come over a span of 14 years.
It's been 10 years since he won one.
Exactly.
When has that ever happened in pro sports?
It doesn't. And to win one at age 37. So you have a guy who is, in his first year as the starting quarterback when he takes over for Bledsoe, winning. And then you have a guy now in what many predicted would sort of be the sunset of his career, and it isn't. And his career, and he could be back here, two, three, four more times.
He could. I'm sorry, Jim, but I was just going to say, he could be quarterback when he's 40?
If anyone can do it, he's that meticulous about his health, as we've read in a number of articles
yes.
that come out recently. If anyone can do it, it's Brady. I mean, I think he pays that much attention and he's that driven. It was interesting. I was watching some of the Brady coverage and then they broke in today with news of Johnny Manziel, the highly drafted, highly recruited Heisman winning quarterback for the Cleveland Browns, and he's entering rehab. And then that was juxtaposed with the story of Brady, the sixth round pick. And I think there's something to Brady, being that sixth round pick. We talk about it all the time and just having that kind of drive and that you get. And I think he is just determined still at this age to prove everyone wrong. I mean, I think there is something that keeps the fire going with what happened to him early in his career.
I'll never forget whoever did the documentary about Brady sitting with his parents when the draft was going on and how when he wasn't picked.
Cried.
He was crying.
Yeah. I watched that clip this
yes.
morning. I watched it this morning just because
yes.
I was
he was crying remembering it.
Yes.
So you can imagine what he was doing when it was
and
actually happening.
He talks about
happening.
How he took a walk
yes.
around the block with his parents and just how absolutely devastating it was and then how elated he was to be picked. in the sixth round by the Patriots because he thinks to himself, oh, gosh, I don't have to be an insurance salesman. And he really thought, you know, it was either get drafted or go into a different line of work. And yep. I think there's something there that in his mindset clicked for him. And he is, you know, that drive continues. I think there's something very valuable in his story.
You know why I can relate to that story about sixth-round draft? I was just thinking, I don't know if you know this, Shira, but when we started in radio, we didn't start. Marjorie did. She was hired by our old station. They tried out every single man who was upright in Boston as her co-host. They, literally. And after they had exhausted the list of all males in Boston, they had one more tryout, and it was me. Is this pretty much close to true?
And that drives you in through today, right?
Exactly. So, you know, let me make the case. I can't believe I'm even doing this, but let me make the case that Brady is the greatest ever. Mm-hmm. To discount the fact that he went there twice and lost, while it is true, he's only won, tied for the most wins with Montana and Bradshaw. He's gone there two more times, and while he hasn't won, he's gotten to the Super Bowl six out of the whatever, 14 years. I mean, it is staggering. And also,
especially in this day and age,
exactly,
when teams are changing. And
with
a
salary cap,
exactly,
so you can't buy an outcome like the Yankees used to do, that
exactly
sort of thing.
And all the personnel that's changed around him and the people he's lost and the people who've gone to other teams. I mean, it is incredibly impressive. You know, that's consistency in this era.
Well, I'm going to say something that's also trite, but not here because we're not exactly a sports radio station. Is the other thing I love about this, if you take away someone like Gronkowski, who is obviously a specimen unlike any that anyone's ever seen, or Randy Moss years ago, mm-hmm, who's great, they're sort of average football players who become great. Well, Julian Edelman, this guy who is unbelievable.
Yes.
This five ten.
I mean, it's sort of strange when I've gone into the Patriots locker room. You know, I'm 5'2", 5'3", on my good days.
You can play.
And I look, I mean, I've been eye to eye, you know, almost eye to eye with some of those players, with the Julian Edelman, and especially, you know, with the Wes Welker. I mean, I was definitely eye to eye with him. And, you know, I'm just thinking to myself, my gosh, you know, what they do have some sort of formula or an ability to pick guys, and this will sound cliche too, I know, but who have heart. Mm. I mean, who really have sort of a desire. And, you know, you look at Butler, you know, in the great interception yesterday.
I love that.
Undrafted
University of West Alabama.
You ever heard of University of West Alabama before?
No, but
I
was reading. No, I was reading today, though, the football coach of University of West Alabama said it was crazy last night on campus. You know, they were chanting, Malcolm, Malcolm,
God,
and UWA, UWA.
So is he a walk-on?
He had a tryout, as I understand it, in the spring to make the 90-man roster. I mean, he was an undrafted rookie. I mean, Bill Belichick, let's give him some credit here, too, has an ability, and his coaching staff, of finding those players whose abilities can exceed what was predicted from them, you know, of them, you know, who go either undrafted or who may have been too small to get a good look. I mean, he really has an ability to figure out, one, who those guys are physically, but also who those guys are mentally. You get a real strong sense that the players who are playing for the Patriots have a mental makeup that is a little bit different, perhaps, than other players.
Do you have any idea of the trajectory from this guy Butler being the tryout in the spring to being on the field yesterday? I mean, he's obviously moved up from just being one of the 90.
Well, he was inserted in the third quarter. I mean, he was a defensive adjustment. He wasn't.
I didn't know that.
He wasn't part of the original, as I understand it, original game plan. But I think, you know, the trajectory, as far as that goes, I think here's a guy who just, you know, was driven, tried out, made the team, wanted to make it work, paid attention in practice. I mean, you know, you hear him talking today about that interception. He said, I knew from practice. I saw this in practice. I knew what the lineup was. I knew what play there. You know, I knew I could do it because he paid attention in practice and they were meticulous in their preparation. And you're thinking, wow, you know, this is a guy who didn't even know if he'd have a shot in the game, but he was paying attention to every little play in their practices where he could potentially make a difference.
You know what's amazing also about this? Marjorie knows one of my other obsessions.
There's so many.
Well, I admit they're a large number. But one of them in the top 20, I'd say. I love those where are they now things. In sports and in life. You know, there's a crime. There's
a
great
Pete
moment.
We know where Pete Rose is now his commercial.
That was humiliating.
It was horrible. Wasn't it?
For those who don't know, Pete Rose has most hits of any player in the history of baseball. He bet on games when he was a manager, so he's barred from getting into the Hall of Fame, even though he'd be there otherwise. And the commercial is him saying he's in the hall. Hall to his house. And it is pathetic. I mean, oh, my God. In any case, what I started to say was The beauty is, you know, in 30 years in Sports Illustrated, there's going to be a story with Malcolm Butler, then weighing 309 pounds, even though he's only 5'10", being an assistant coach at the high school in
Alabama, University of West
Alabama, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's the guy, because isn't that the takeaway from yesterday's
game?
He's
set for life.
The thing you're going to remember forever, whether you're a Patriot fan or critic, was the pass that was intercepted by this walk-on. I mean, it's such an it's really, even if you don't like football and don't care about it, and I know we talked about the downside, but the game was played, and it's huge. It's the biggest thing in America. The fact that this guy, who was a nobody, ends up being the star is so great.
I was
going to
say, and not only was a nobody, could have been the biggest goat of the
true.
Game.
It's great.
You know, because he couldn't break up that pass on the previous plays, you know, in the previous
play. For the guy who caught
exactly.
on his back
the
when it was
for the bobble
around.
Catch.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly,
now,
exactly.
One last thing. We're not a sports show, but you are a sports reporter, so I have to ask your analysis of why not a run and why a pass.
Well,
at all.
Before you, let me just tell you something. I read a couple of minutes ago, a friend of mine, big time Democratic consultant, emailed me a few minutes ago, say ESPN reported this morning, despite the conventional wisdom. This is this guy, Marshawn Lynch, who ran the ball 4 yards to the 1 yard line. They had three downs to score. ESPN is reporting five times a season.
Yeah.
He's been on the 1 yard line and has only scored once.
Yeah, is exactly.
So
exactly.
Maybe the coach is saying it's an easy pass. Even though it seems ridiculous. And they said, let's just get it over with. No, you don't buy it.
I don't buy it. I don't buy it. And, I read some of the comments and heard the comments that Seattle Seahawks coach Pete Carroll was making after the game. And it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. He was saying, what he said was, we were going to run the ball to win the game, but not on that play. I didn't want to waste a run play on their goal line guys. It was a clear thought, but it didn't work out right. Butler made a play that no one would have thought he could make. I understand he saw personnel there and he didn't want to do a run play. I get that thinking, but I don't like the notion of we didn't want to waste a run play.
Yeah, waste run. The game is seconds away from
exactly,
the end.
You're seconds away from winning the Super Bowl. It doesn't make any sense to me. And then he talks about Butler making a play that no one thought he could make. Well, that's your job, Pete Carroll. That is your job. That is why you are paid the big bucks, to anticipate plays and prepare for plays that you don't think that are unlikely, opposing player is unlikely to make. That's why you get paid.
Last question, Shira Springer. The governor called us before about the weather.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were speaking to Governor Baker, he and we were talking about the game. And what did he say? He was jumping up and down like a little kid in his house in the swamp.
Things, doing childish things. High-fiving and screeching.
So are you one of those people who pretends that you're impartial in this sort of situation? Or were you like wildly excited like all of us were?
I have trouble actually watching, at the end of this. When you're, it's like, oh God, what's going to happen?
Because you're nervous.
I'm nervous, I think, but also it's just like, oh gosh. And it goes way, way, way back to, when I was a kid, when we used to be big fans of UConn basketball in my family. And you probably remember the Tate George shot, the Scott Burrell down the length of the court, the Tate George shot, et cetera, et cetera. I spent that in a bathroom with my mom and my sister because we were so terrified of watching.
That's
and we
great.
Only heard my father screaming downstairs at the
That's
the win
good.
And had to watch the replay. So for some reason, I'm not great with end-of-game situations and watching.
I don't think that was your father. I think that was Governor Baker, actually.
Screaming.
Shira Springer, it's great to see you. Great to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks. Shira Springer is an investigative reporter for the Boston Globe, and she joins us a lot to talk about sports. Thank you very much, Shira Springer.
Thank you.
Okay, coming up. All you hardy souls out there, have you ever thought of trading in your life's worth of winter stamina? Your hard-earned winter fortitude to move to more tropical or temperate climes? How many of you just know in some zero days it takes to get you to pack it up and think, Florida, it could be my new home? We're going to talk about this winter of masochism next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We don't have much time, but we really wanted to touch on this. How many winters have you lived through? How many gloves do you have to buy each year? How many bags of salt have you schlepped home? How many hours do you stand freezing at a bus stop, wondering if a functioning bus would ever come? How many hours have you spent freezing, scraping the ice off your car? If the answer is too many times, did you do something about it? Like trade in a life's worth of winter weather that Marjorie and I both experienced to live somewhere else. We want to know at 877-301-8970, how close do you get when you have a stretch like this to say, what is up? Why am I doing this?
Oh, I'm there. By the way, I'm already there.
I love Boston. I've lived in Philly. I've lived in New York. There's no place I love like I love this. This is abject torture.
It's ridiculous.
Torture.
It's like we're Alaska. You know, you talked before about binge watching making you depressed. This makes me depressed. The idea, you know, that just to go you want to go down to CVS and pick up a prescription, or you want to go run to the store and get some milk. It's such a production. You have to put on your boots and you have to put on your hat.
Did you see Shira Springer walking out of here?
She was in her special running gear. She had these special boots on, the whole thing.
And hat and jacket.
The whole thing. You know, if you have a dog, it's like a nightmare to go out and walk the dog. You have to get all that special. Although I did notice at the hardware store yesterday, they have a lot more of the pet-friendly salt. So because the salt gets
get
in the dog's
paws. Yeah.
And you have to have the Musher Secret, which I happen to have for my dog. The Musher Secret.
Oh, you mentioned that.
That's
yeah.
the special stuff you put on their little paws so they don't get the salt, doesn't hurt them. But if you walk far enough, it wears off, and the salt does hurt them. So the whole thing, and then worrying about the ice. I mean, you're always worried about slipping on the ice. It's really hard when half the people don't even shovel their driveways or shovel their walks. And today it will be okay because there's so much snow. But it's just a nightmare. The whole thing is a nightmare. You know what's really terrible?
No.
When the snow is coming in your face.
Oh.
When it's like sideways like that. It's absolutely
But you
awful.
Say to yourself, and again, I have never made this choice, so I feel a little foolish. But I feel a little foolish saying much of what I say. So let me just get this out. You could be – like you're watching Arizona. I mean, Arizona is not my cup of tea in a lot of ways. But you say you wake up every day and it's pretty nice.
Right. So
that woman called us from San Diego about an hour ago. Mm-hmm. You wake up every day. It's 80 degrees. And by the way, well, some people say seasons are nice, that sort of thing. It's just – it is really painful. Even if you're a winter sports person, which I am not. I don't skate. I don't like any of those kind of things. But even if you're into that – this is really hard.
Yeah, it's hard because it's hard to conduct your day-to-day life. It's hard to pick up the kids at school.
It also hurts.
It hurts. It's terrible. On the other hand, having lived in California, when it's the same all the time, you don't have the joy of spring either.
You don't get to have the pain of winter.
This is a little excessive. We don't really need this much of winter. I mean, it's 30 degrees.
It's going to be 1 degree tonight.
Yeah, 1 degree tonight. That's always fun, I think.
877-301-8970. And by the way, if you know anybody who's left town, we're not arguing anybody should. You should stay here and we'll all get along together beautifully. What was the tipping point? What was the thing that caused somebody who was a lifer, for example, a New England lifer or an East Coast lifer, who finally said, and I don't mean somebody who's 80 who moves to Florida. I mean a person in the prime of their life who says, I just can't take this anymore. I really don't want to have to endure this. I'm leaving.
I think that's why people
Do you know anybody?
Go down.
I don't know one.
A friend of mine just yesterday was talking about moving to Florida.
Do you know
Florida.
Anybody who's done it?
No, I don't.
Nor do I.
Well, actually, I do. I do. I know a couple of lawyers that do a lot of business from Florida during the wintertime. And some people that go even further, they go into the Caribbean and they do their business from the Caribbean. I used to live in Burlington, Vermont. And as everybody knows, that's on Lake Champlain. So I walked to work in the morning. It was only like about a block and a half. And the wind would be coming off Lake Champlain. And Burlington is really cold. And it was so cold, sometimes you put Vaseline on your face so that it wouldn't get frostbitten when the water. And I remember, I got used to it, though, because you get the warm clothes and all that kind of thing. But I remember being up there and when it snowed in May, and that was it.
That's horrible.
I said, I got to get out of here. I can't stand
this. So you moved to Boston.
That's right. I moved to Boston, but at least it wasn't zero all the time. I mean, Burlington is really close to the Canadian border. It's absolutely freezing.
That.
I can't imagine what it's like up there today. That's the thing, the cold. You know, I don't know which is worse, the snow or the cold. Who are these people that want to climb mountains? You know what I mean? Every time I think about this, I think of these people go up Mount Everest.
How about winter camping?
Winter camping.
People
That's
by
insane.
Choice. It's one thing if you're stranded in the wilderness.
Yeah.
Some people say, oh, it's Monday. I only have 4 days to wait till we go winter camping on Mount Washington. Wow. Let's go to Jason in Brookline. Is it masochism to stay in this kind of environment? What's the deal, Jason? Hi.
Hi. Well, I grew up in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And when I was about 19, I moved to San Diego.
Oh.
And, it is lovely all the time, but I was there for about 4 years, and it drove me nuts because at least if you're from here, the seasons, they're great and everything, but you use them as a mark of the passage of time.
Yeah.
And so, you refer to like, oh, that was 2 winters ago. Oh, that was last spring. I feel like I had a normal life and then I moved to San Diego one spring and it was just like this blur of summer. for years. And I actually moved to Tucson, Arizona from San Diego. And even that was like, okay, there's summer and there's winter. But it was like a godsend to have the seasons change again. Though, you know, in the winter you get 20s at night down in Tucson. So it does get cold, not often.
Yeah, seasons are great. Three of them are great.
Something about, I think your brain goes soft when you live in beautiful weather all the time.
You do?
Yeah. I just don't think, because you can retreat into nature all the time, and it seems great. But for me anyway, I mean, I know a lot of people love it. The best day I was in California was the day it snowed. Everybody had to rush inside. And
I felt like, I did feel like you never actually went outside. It was like being in sort of a giant shopping mall.
Exactly.
Always.
Yeah.
Because it never
That's
even
a beautiful
rained,
image, but. Jason, actually. That really captures
and
it.
And also, the
Jason,
other thing
thanks.
Is, I think it's hard to when the weather's beautiful. I mean, you know how when the weather's beautiful in the spring or the summer, you think, oh, I should be outside today? Yeah. Well, when the weather's beautiful all the time.
You don't have that feeling.
I did, because I was, from Massachusetts. But I found it difficult to do hard work, like to do my schoolwork and stuff like that, because it was so beautiful outside. I felt like I shouldn't have to do my schoolwork. Mm. There's something unproductive, I think, about all that gorgeous weather.
Mm. So it's better to have frostbite and be an abject pain from the cold
no,
and the
I,
snow
I don't,
to
I don't
get you to
like
do your
this,
work.
But I'm not sure I want to live in San Diego.
You know, season, there's no question. And three of the seasons are great. The only problem with fall. Fall is beautiful, too. What's the problem with fall?
Winter's coming.
Exactly. Winter comes after it. So there are 2.5 fabulous seasons. And by the way, we'll do a show on this. I'm sure we probably did last year, too. When spring, even if it's only a day and gets cold again, but when you know that you're there.
That's right.
Is there a joy that equals the feeling?
See that little crocus coming up? Little tiny little bud.
No, it's really, she's making fun of me, but it is, there's nothing like it. Let's go to Neil in Bellingham. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Neil.
Hey.
Hi.
I'm glad I got through.
Great.
I listen to you guys all the time.
Well, thank you, Neil.
Thank you.
I actually binge on Jim and Marjorie.
Well, we like that kind of binging a
great,
lot.
Great, Neil. What's up?
I don't have a TV, but I just love weather. Weather is great.
You love this?
Just anything.
Really?
Now, why? What's up with that, Neil?
Well, you got to deal with weather wherever you go, so here I am.
Yeah, but there are other places that have weather that's less difficult to deal with, right? I mean, you sound like you have a Zen philosophy. Your attitude is, I will deal and thrive on whatever is. Is that not, you sound like that kind of person, yes?
There's only so many places you can go, though.
That is a fine. Neil, thank you. He's a lot healthier mentally than I am.
We have big windows here in the studio. And
they're beautiful, actually.
They are beautiful. And there's a tea stop right across the street.
Yep.
And before, I was trying to get your attention, but you were busy talking about something, so you ignore me completely. I do have to wave my arms at the air traffic controller
okay,
when Jim's in the middle of the soliloquy. Anyway, there's a tea stop, and I was looking at this person that was standing out there.
How long?
They must have been standing there for 15 minutes. And they had the hat and the scarf and the thing. They're holding onto the pole, and the wind is whipping, and they're waiting for the bus to come. And thank God the bus finally came, but this poor person out there, can you imagine waiting 15 or 20 minutes today for a T-bus? It's just awful.
No,
absolutely terrible. Alice from Cambridge, what do you think about this horrible, horrible winter weather?
Hi, Alice.
Hi. No, I was telling your person that I'm born in New York.
Yeah.
I spent 21 years in Louisiana as I was an attorney. I'm a BU law school graduate, mm-hmm. also Barnard. I'm a Northeastern person. 21 years in Louisiana, my husband finally took me away and took me to Cape Cod, and now we live in Cambridge. I treasure every gray cloud.
You do?
Nobody can understand. I am so happy when the weather is gray, when the snow comes, when the rain comes. It's so nourishing to me.
Oh,
it's
my God.
It's so beautiful. If I ever have to, and we do visit New Orleans, and I love Jazz Fest. And I love New Orleans. I mean, they're my people. But oh my God, if there's snow, I'm happy. A snow day, and why? Because the alternative is awful.
What do you mean, alternative? Being dead? Is that what you meant, Alice? What do you mean?
No.
What do you mean?
The alternative is living with hot weather with sun. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Alice, thank you. That was beautiful, actually. It was almost poetic, but I'm sorry. I mean, you know, you and Alice are taking pretty much the same position. Waking up and it being warm and having the sun shining down on you is not an appealing notion every day.
It is appealing, but when it happens, when it's the same every day, this is something weird about it.
Well, because you're not used to it, obviously. You're an East Coaster, as am I.
Okay, but Richard says, I'm from San Francisco, always dreamed of the Four Seasons. In the late 80s, moved to Minnesota, wow, and Chicago, oh, worse. And here, ever since, in Boston, Richard says, I'm done. We're moving to Palm Springs in a couple
Wait,
of months.
Wait, is that
months.
Person serious or you can't
He's
tell?
He's done. He's moving. He says we can always drive to the mountains for snow if we want to see it. Ooh, we are done with the show, speaking of done.
The problem, I thought a lot about this. Could you do Boston Public Radio from Santa Barbara? And I just don't think so.
No, you couldn't because you'd be thinking Boston. I should be getting my surfboard out, Jim.
Yeah,
you'd
I'm
be
a big out, surfer.
You'd be doing the curl. Yeah, you'd I'm be riding amazing. Those waves in your booty.
Hanging 10, me.
And your little puka shell necklace.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank
like
you.
Like your old boyfriend.
That's right. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we have open mic with Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, and writer Nick Hornby will be here. I'm so excited about that. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, and our engineer is John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for listening. Please tune in tomorrow, and good luck getting home if you're not already there.